teen angels from his prehistoric block of glacier ice comes the world's first superhero, Captain Caveman. Now the constant companion to the teen angels, Brenda, Dee Dee, and Taffy, in their hilarious and sometimes scary mystery missions. Get ready for Captain Caveman and the teen angels.
Morning.
Good morning.
Today it is morning.
Indeed.
Yeah. Starting
good
a little earlier.
Morning. Colorado Springs.
That's right. All right, Steve is ready to go, I believe, so I am going to add him, our special guest, Steve Zenoda. Noob. And this is Geek Brunch Retro, number 7. Lucky number seven.
Hello.
Good morning, noob.
Hello.
You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Can you hear us?
Say something. You sound kind of low. Hold on.
All right. It's his mixer. Earpiece. He's got all this fancy equipment. He has to deal with the knobs and all this kind of crap. Where I just plug in my USB, I'm ready to go.
No, I went very low tech today, man. I went just. Go. So say something now.
Testing.
There we go. Yeah, it helped when the plug is plugged all the way in. Yeah, I was very low tech today. Right now, I'm just on my iPhone and my earbuds and my speaker. Oh. I mean, and my microphone. I'm very low tech today.
Yeah, last night you were high tech.
Yeah, well, you know, I got the studio set up downstairs, and what I do is I come downstairs in the garage to smoke off the studio. And I usually don't podcast from upstairs in the living room because the wife is home, my daughter's home, but they're both out today till like 6 o'clock. I said, you know what? I want to do this in the living room today. Relax on a couch. We're talking cartoons. We're talking Kirby. You need to be sitting down relaxing to be talking about this stuff. Just like I should just get my bowl of tricks too because – that was my tradition. Is that Chris on the line too there? We got
yeah,
one.
Yep.
Hey, Chris. Nice to finally talk to you, man.
Are you guys getting feedback? Or is it just me?
I'm getting some echo.
I think it's coming from you, Steve.
That's my garage. Hello. It'll disappear when I go up. Hold on.
All right, we're actually hearing ourselves. Well, now it sounds better.
It sounds better now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's the garage. I should do.
It's your bomb shelter.
Yeah, I should do a doo-wop band. Yeah, I'm going to go upstairs in a second. I'm just smoking my, not King George, what's the name of his name? Captain Black.
Ah, there you go.
Captain Black pipe tobacco. I'm smoking on a Sunday morning. I had my coffee. I got my coffee ready to go.
And, is that pirate tobacco?
No. Actually, it's on the higher end. I've been smoking a long time. I had a misspent youth. And
I've seen all those vodka bottles.
I've been smoking since I'm like 11 years old, and then I was smoking cigarettes, and then I quit for 3 years, man. Three. And then I got divorced, and I was back in the bars again, and all of that stuff, so I ended up smoking again. And then the girl I ended up being with, she quits on me. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. And then she didn't just quit. She became one of the Nazi non-smokers. You know, how dare you light up anywhere near any place that, you know, don't you know there's a school three blocks from here? I'm like, you gotta leave me alone. So, yes, I got all my notes ready to go. I'm good to go. How's everybody doing today?
Good.
I'm doing pretty good. I got a flu shot yesterday and it made me kind of tired.
Yeah, it'll do that.
It'll give you the flu.
Yeah, it gives you like a nasty cold, and it's like, well, thanks for that. And
some people have that effect. Last time I got it, this is the same thing that happened. I felt like I was a little run down, so I was kind of sleepy yesterday, and my arm's a little sore this morning. But
you know, you should have gotten it earlier because the flu season's going away now.
Yeah, well,
I mean, statistically.
Yeah, I mean, partially. It was normally I would get it sooner, and I just kept forgetting. And one of the main reasons is because Kara, my girlfriend, her new nephew was just born a couple months ago, and he's
congrats.
Thanks. They live in New York City, but they're coming to visit in a couple weeks. So just to, you know, for peace of mind and for the mother to have had the flu shot and stuff.
Don't lie. You have inside information. There's something nasty coming, isn't there? Hey, Chris, did I hear you say something about upstate New York, or was I phasing in and out of a dream at the time that I was listening to the podcast? Are you, like, from New York?
Yeah, I'm near Buffalo. I grew up in Niagara Falls.
Okay. I got a lot of family up in Fredonia. Believe it or not.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's just a couple hours from here. I had a friend that went to school there.
Yeah,
that's a big thing for Donia.
Every summer they'd ship us off there. And it would blow our minds because, you know, we didn't see two trees in a row for miles. And then all of a sudden it's like trees and creeks and there's animals. And it was beautiful. I loved it. And, you know, it's like my Stephen King Stand By Me memories come from Fredonia, New York.
You mean you vomited up pie or a pie eating contest?
No, but we did find a dead body by the railroad.
you could do that in any state. All right. Well, this is Geek Brunch Retrocast. I am Mike, and we have Chris, and we're joined by Steve Noob, our special guest. And we're normally
from the Altered Egos podcast. First, he's a three. You'll find us. We'll be in the show notes, I'm sure.
Yes. And we brought Steve in to talk about a special topic today because we're going to be talking about Saturday morning cartoons.
Yes.
And
suggested by Steve.
Yeah, suggested by Steve. And I thought we would open up with the omnibus, or the three issues that we're going to talk about, then get into the cartoon talk, and then finish up with miscellaneous stuff. So
works for me.
On the agenda today is we actually finished Omnibus Volume 1, and we're now delving into Omnibus Volume 2. And the first of the stories was The Forever People, number 4.
Yes.
Which sports a beautiful cover with all of the Forever People in a prison-type scenario. And I really like this, because this was freaking creepy, and it shows how twisted the sod is, like how he likes people to suffer.
Well, you know, you got me, and let me start by saying a little bit of my background on this.
Mm-hmm.
I had read bits and pieces of this when I was a kid. And as I was looking back through some of these books, and some of them I had on reprint, some of them I had digitally, some of them I had collections of, but some of these covers were not kid-friendly, and I could see, and I don't mean kid-friendly by, like, adult, mature, like, porno-type thing. It was very dark. Mm-hmm. And the themes, especially on the Forever People, what I read, I happened to read, Mike told me to read Forever People number 3, but I kept reading, thank goodness, because I got so sucked up in the story. But the whole, there are a lot of undertones in this story that were really ahead of their time. And I was very, of course, the Kirby artwork, you could just take all the words out of these stories and they would still almost be just as good. But some of these undertones are like, live by my rules or die. Anything is justifiable because of the anti-life. And it's straight up Nazi rhetoric, you know? They got guys marking window storefronts for people who aren't complying or people that didn't fit in. I tell you the truth, I was pretty blown away by a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, that was definitely a big thing, like in issue 3, because we talked about it last time. The parallels to Nazi Germany are very strong, I thought. And that's where we're coming into with this issue with
the death camp. He called it his Kingdom of the Damned. His Camp of the Damned.
It's pretty much like a concentration camp kind of situation. That's really the only, I think, indication we got last time. But this time we find out that it's even a bit more, well, I don't know that I would want to say more disturbing.
It's more twisted because it looks like a false front. Like, it's an amusement park.
Happy Land.
Yeah.
Yeah, posing as a... Yeah, right, exactly. It's posing as Happy Land, but it's really not Happy Land. All right, so let me not interrupt you guys any further. I just wanted to give you guys my impression of Forever People in general.
No, and I was actually, that was good time, so I was going to ask you if, you know, you had these issues or what your kind of experience or background, because I know, you know, we've talked about how Mike has read these several times, whereas I'm, you know, reading them for the first time, so.
Well, I'll tell you one more thing. If, like, Forever People number 3, when he's standing on, you see the guy with the Justifier helmet on saying, live by my rules or die. Everything is possible through anti-life. It was very ahead of its time in that you had in this issue, you had not only the anything is justifiable through anti-life, but you had a suicide bomber. You had, and not only was he just a suicide bomber, if that bomb went off, it gave off material. So Kirby was seeing, you know, suicide bombers with dirty, quote unquote, dirty bombs way ahead of his time.
Oh yeah, well, if you start reading OMAC and stuff, I mean it freaking will blow you away. I mean, he's like a visionary that saw a lot of stuff. And I don't know what his background is as far as like as a human being, if he read a lot of novels. I wouldn't think he'd read a lot because he was constantly drawing.
Working.
He was pumping out so many books at Marvel and in DC that I don't know if he had time to do anything, because if you look at the 60s and 70s, it was all Kirby. I mean, he was creating things left and right.
Some of it, though, he gets away with, and I'll get into this in another issue that we're going to get into, but I said to myself, part of this had to be DC editorial saying, do you know he's doing this? And the chief editor going, look, he's Jack Kirby. Don't be looking at his work.
That's exactly what I think was happening.
Just print what he gives you and it'll sell. Believe me.
Yeah. I think some of this stuff might not have seen the light of day if it wasn't by him, you know?
But I think people also didn't know what they were getting into. Like at the time, I don't think it sold well because nothing really had a good run except for maybe Commandy, you know?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And these aren't, you know what the problem is? I'm going to tell you what I thought what the problem was personally is that they weren't kid-friendly covers, really. Like, they weren't the traditional colorful superheroes. Like, if you look at Forever People number 3, Forever People number 4, you've got those two red figures with the guns and everybody laying around. That's on 4. And on 3, you got the guy heavily masked. You can't see his features. And then the people are all cast in red. And it doesn't give them an individuality, which I thought was all. And here's another thing where Kirby's at, way ahead of his time, in that they get together, they perform the ritual, and form the Infinity Man. And I thought that, you know, that's like every Japanimation I've seen. All of the things get together to form something else. And I just thought it was incredible.
Yeah, like Voltron or...
That's the thing, yeah, right. though, man, I don't know what came first. Because Voltron was pretty damn old, wasn't it?
Was it? I don't know if it was pre-70s.
I don't think it was that old, no.
But I'm sure that there was other people that had done that before Kirby, like, become one. The many become one.
A part of me said to myself, but why do they even need these other people then? If you got this Infinity Man, he knows everything that's going on immediately. It's not like he got...
And that's when he really has power, too. It's like, why don't just stay Infinity Man all the time?
Exactly.
Except that it looks like Desaad in issue 3 or 2 knew how to revert that and turn him back.
Yeah, I know. He got that. That revival, and then all of a sudden, oh no!
Yeah, I think that was an important, so Infinity Man's not too powerful. He was able to reverse it, and that took away, you know, because prior to that, anytime there was any kind of danger, the Forever People just, okay, let's just form into Infinity Man. That's going to solve our problems. So you had to take that away to create some drama, you know?
Yeah.
And I think also, like, maybe I was just reading this into it, or maybe I was making this up in my head, but I got like an impression that there's a certain amount of limitations on, like, the only way Infinity Man can appear is if they trade places with him. So in a sense, it's like if Infinity Man always stuck around, they'd be stuck wherever they go, you know? So it's almost like
it's like a Firestorm thing, except that
they have to like
inside of, I bet, inside of some void or something.
Yeah, they have to kind of sacrifice their individuality for a period of time. So, you know, those are kind of some good reasons for them to...
I always thought that would suck, like to be the Professor Stein behind Firestorm, because you can't physically do anything. Like, somebody else is in charge of the body. All you're there is kind of providing a voice.
You're giving suggestions.
Yeah, that would suck.
It would.
Well, especially, I mean, in the original incarnation, he didn't even remember that he was forming Firestorm. He had no idea. Right. He thought he was just blacking out, and he became an alcoholic because of it, because he thought he was going crazy.
Now, Jake's having to deal with it. He's the one in the Professor Stein role.
One quick thing, and this is my last tangent I'll go down outside of these issues while we're talking here, is you were talking about Kirby and his experiences. I don't know if you guys have ever covered, when they did Captain America originally, Simon and... oh my God, I have it right here. Simon and Kirby. That was before we had gotten into the war, okay? So you've got him punching Hitler in the face before we even get into World War II. And there was an active Nazi party here in the United States. And they would go to, it was Atlas at the time, I believe it was, who was printing. Mm-hmm. And they would show up in the lobby demanding to see Kirby because they were going to kick his ass. And Kirby, as what was he, 5'8", all 5'7", six of them, would roll up his sleeves.
I did read that in a novel.
tell him to stay down there and I'll kick their ass when I get down there.
Every time I read Scrapper, you know, I think Scrapper is Jack.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I think he's not going to take shit from anybody.
That's a good call. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's a lot of stories when, even like, when people were demanding money, like, because they were working in a building or something, that he would come out. He was a pretty badass, man. I think he was fearless.
Don't they realize I have pages to do?
I got these comics to draw, damn it. he is really a fascinating artist. And, man, it's incredible watching his journey through, you know, what started off with, you know, Simon and Kirby. Because his style has changed dramatically to what we know now.
Have you ever read his Fight American?
Yeah, I was just telling Chris I just bought like issue 4 and 5 of Fighting American and the originals, and they were quite expensive, but they're my earliest Kirby work that I have.
Oh, you bought the originals?
Yeah, I bought the originals that are not in collected. You know what I mean? They're not in collected form. They're original.
And I had for sale on eBay. I will confess for a while because I read the whole thing. I loved it. It's by Titan Books, Fighting American, from the creators, and it is about, let's call it 200 pages long. And I don't know what issue it starts with, but hold on, I'll tell you in a second. No, Fighting Americans 1 through 7, and then volume 2, 1 and 2. That's it.
Ah.
So, since you, Mike, you want me to send this out to you, then you could send it out to Chris and just have a blast with it?
Yeah, that would be an interesting to see.
All right, cool. You just ping me your address, and I'll send it out to you guys, and you guys will have a party with it. I don't even need it back. Just pass it on to someone else that needs the Kirby knowledge.
The Kirby knowledge.
Nice.
But, man, I'm trying to find all of it. And there's some pieces that I'm like, wow, that's Jack. Like, I was reading some horror stuff that he was doing, and I couldn't recognize the line, you know? It just looks so different.
And like when he did Rickles, it's like, this is like animation art, you know? And it's like, I can't believe the same guy drew this. It was good, but it still just blows your mind.
And a matter of fact, we were...
You know, to me, who the hell is inking Jack Kirby? You would have to have a team of people right now. Just the ink, what he used to put out.
It was all Vince Coletta, man.
I know. Poor unsung Vince Coletta. He just...
He gets the shit, though. He gets shit on. Of all the Kirby inkers, he does get shit on.
Yeah.
But I hear he gets shit on for a good reason, because he did, Vince Coletta did so much. I mean, quantity, that he often would erase lines. He would do certain things just right, so he could get it out on time. He was just trying to do his work as fast as he could so he can get on to the next book.
And then keeping his story organized. That's the other thing, guys. I don't understand this. Maybe you guys can shed some light on this for me. Today, in our world today of comics, we would have on our books, on our newsstands, on our shelves in our comic store, we would have Fourth World Part 1 banners. Okay, or Fourth World Part 2 banners, or Fourth World Part 3 banners. This story begged for that treatment, and I think that's another reason that hurt it.
Yeah, it could, because they're kind of interlinked.
They are. And then it's like you go from one place to another. Anti-Gang is, who's Anti-Gang? I never heard of him. Meanwhile, there's a whole story about Anti-Gang just an issue ago in some other book you never heard of before.
Yeah. One thing that's good about it, though, is I think you could take, like, we're reading these in the order they were published, but I think you can read one in a standalone sitting and still understand what the hell's going on. You could read Mr. Miracle and understand it. You could read Forever People. True. Superman's Pal is kind of like its own entity. One of the things that we talk about at the issues, like, what is our favorite? and this one, like, did a flip-flop for me, because I wasn't too crazy about the Don Rickles issue, the last one. And this one, I absolutely loved it. I thought it was fucking hilarious. So it was like, I did a flip flop. And me and Chris were talking, is like, I didn't know Don Rickles that much. Like, I knew he appeared on some like night shows and was a comedian and was kind of brash. But yeah. I didn't know he wasn't like in my timeline where he was popular. So this was kind of like new Don Rickles to me, so yeah. And I'm dying to know, like, if anybody does know, if he decided to put Don Rickles in there, like, because he was a fan, like, he says, I'm going to put Don Rickles in there, or if somebody kind of drove him to put that in there.
Well, they put a photo right on the cover, so I would imagine Rickles' people got a check somewhere along the line and just said,
oh, yeah,
we're just going to do Dick, and what, you know, here's your check. But I'm a huge Rickles fan. I'm just a little bit older than you, Mike, and he just made that cusp with me where I think it was all to bedtimes. It was like, because Rickles wouldn't come on till after like 10.
Was he like the Andrew Dice Clay of that time period, or what?
Yes. Yeah. Actually, he was what, today he's like the Andrew Dice Clay.
That's kind of what I was thinking about when I was reading it. Like, yeah. I was just correlating it. It came to mind. I don't know why, but did.
Yep. All right. So I'm sorry, guys. Go ahead.
All right. So let's jump into Forever People number 3. And like we said, it opens up with a lot
four.
Of torturing
four.
Before. I can't get it in my head. They all seem to merge into numbers. But yeah. they have this cool splash page. Well, before the splash page, you have a one panel where these people are like trapped in this mouth.
Yeah.
They're like screaming and they're choking and they're like, help, let me out. But when everybody else physically sees them in the amusement park, it looks like they're having the time of their lives, and they're laughing.
And their screams. Yeah, their screams are turned into laughter.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting about this panel? It doesn't look like everyone's suffering, and I wonder if that's just, you know, it seems like there's people walking, you know, like there's a older guy, like a grandpa, walking his grandkid, and they run into Darkseid.
Hi.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's the big thing. Like, the thing that's disturbing about it is Happy Land's a legit, like, seems like a legitimate amusement park for the people that visit it, and it's like the people that are being tortured are tortured behind the scenes.
I wonder if Jack is trying to say something about Walt Disney.
You know what they call Disneyland? The ex-employees.
What are they?
Swear to God, I spent some time in Florida. They used to call it Mousewitz. They used to call Disney.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, that's how bad it was at the point. One question I have for you guys is, there's lots of references, especially by Gottfried, to us, in quotes, let's call it, and the right people, and anti-life, and how I think anti-life is a genius word, genius, because it is, yep, sure, you want life, we'll give you anti-life. And like, we're so desperate to live, we'll take something called anti what it is we want. And I think it comes directly from Jack growing up during that time and knowing what happened over there. And I think there's a lot of allusions to Europe in here. So
yeah.
World War II. So.
Yeah, definitely.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, well, I think it was the giant tent of Glorious Godfrey that you're talking about, and we get like a little bit of recap of that stuff from that last issue. So forever people are talking about it, and they also had the other thing was the Justifiers, which are kind of like the Gestapo or
Stormtroop, the
Stormtroopers,
suicide bomber Stormtroopers. That's what they were.
Pretty much, yeah. We also we see a little bit more of the connection that because he hasn't been like, he didn't just come out right up front and put out, okay, here's the Forever People and here are their powers. This is what they do. It's been kind of over time. We've been inferring like what's going on with them, and Viken. It's been clear he's the one that's had the biggest connection to the Mother Box. But we see for the first time he takes off his helmet and that he's got a there's actual technology in his helmet with a sensor that lets him know how close the Mother Box is, because that's actually kind of an important plot point too here, is the Forever People have relied so much so far on the Mother Box, and they've actually been separated from it from the first time, so that puts them in a pretty perilous situation. You know, we also get Seraphim, the guy that has like the Western style outfit. He tries to use the pellets that or capsules or whatever that he has on his hat this time, and you know, Desaad's people at this point are pretty much, they know all their secrets, right? They're like, there's no mystery here, and the Forever People really, there's not much they can do to defend themselves, because everything that they try to do is anticipated. So
they're in a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, they pretty much get taken out.
The one thing I found absolutely fascinating is Desaad is trying to torture the Mother Box. Like, he's trying to make it scream and torture it in front of, you know, Desaad. I mean, before the Dark Side. That was just craziness.
And Dark Side seems amused that he would even try it.
Yeah, he's like, what the hell are you doing?
He's like, you are one crazy motherfucker.
And the thing is just going, ping, 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 ping.
I actually think that Darkseid thinks that Desaad is a little, you know, crazy. Like, this motherfucker is insane.
Well, it's Goebbels. I'm sorry, I keep going back to just Goebbels and Himmler. You know what I mean? It's your friend, man, and it's your freaking psycho in the background. And Desaad's got his uses, and Godfrey's got his uses. He's the face of the people, you know, of the movement.
Yeah.
He's the happy-go-lucky, you know, come with me, everything's going to be great guy. And Desaad, meanwhile, is the ugly guy. You know what I mean? He's not grotesque. I mean, he's kind of grotesque, but he's not like the traditional monster. But he's the guy you go to when you need people tortured. Every one of these fascist movements need one of those guys. And he's the guy. And Darkseid plays them both against each other. Beautiful.
You know that's like the concentration camp dude that's torturing people.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, you see it anytime like there's a regime like Nazi Germany. I mean, if Dessaud was in America, you know, or something like that today, he'd be a serial killer or something.
Right.
He'd find some way to act out his impulses, but like where you're talking about Darkseid, you're talking about Hitler or whoever, you know, they find these people and they make use of them, you know, for their own purposes. You know, let them do the really, you know, dirty work, and, you know, turn it to their own benefit kind of thing.
Yep.
Whereas Darkseid's just focused on the anti-life. I mean, he's the more focus of the group.
He's the brain.
And this is what I thought was amazing. This was what was amazing to me. Where Godfrey and Dessaud believe in the power of the anti-life. To Darkseid, the power of the anti-life is nothing. I want the equation that runs the anti-life. That's how far above his aspirations are to his lackeys. You know, he wants to control the anti-life, where the other guys just want to worship it. And that's why Darkseid is the boss. You know, his aspirations are much higher.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, yeah, we saw that with, like they said, with the aspirations, we saw that. I don't know if you read it, but we had a previous issue where Darkseid lets Mantis loose. And it's the same kind of situation. Mantis, you know, is happy to wake up, do his thing, scare people, whatever, you know, but that's as far as it goes. He doesn't have a greater ambition. So Darkseid uses him, and Darkseid's got the greater plan. You know?
That was a little bit different from the other two, though, because he almost wanted to fight Darkseid because he was almost like, you gave me Earth, or you gave me this piece, and mm-hmm. now you're trying to take it away.
Yeah.
Because the other guy, so far, I mean, through the history of DC, Dessaud has always been mischievous. Like, mm-hmm. Darkseid even knows he can't trust him. He's like, this guy's got his own agenda. He's a crazy motherfucker. I gotta watch my back. Like I don't know how many times he's blasted Dessaud with his Omega beams. But it's more than I can count. And man, this to see this and all the characters relate to Darkseid is amazing. And this whole setup is so futuristic that it just blows my mind. Like, there's so much undertones in this book that you could derive so much discussion off of everything you see.
And it's a good segue for me. I was one of the people on the face of this earth that hated. I mean, I'd rather do 4 root canals than read, what was it, Final Crisis? The one by Morrison.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Before I read that again, I would rather have 4 root canals. Now that I'm reading this, I'm starting to see the connections.
You see what Grant was doing.
Yeah, I'm starting to see more about what Grant was doing. And I'm like, maybe it wasn't as bad as I thought it was.
Oh, hell yeah. And you see like Sonny Sumu.
I'm like, well, now that's where that guy came from,
yeah.
And not for nothing, dude. If your name is Orion and you come to another planet and you're disguising yourself, you don't name yourself Detective O-apostrophe Ryan.
Oh, Ryan. I thought that was great. That was awesome.
I was literally laughing for 10 minutes. I said, really? That's like, okay, my name is Smith on this other world. Here, you call me Smythe. So,
well, I think it's even worse than that, isn't it? Like, I think he doesn't even initially come up with that. I think he says his real name, and it's just misheard as O-apostrophe Ryan. Hey, you know what? I think I'll use that.
Yeah, that sounds perfect. I have a plan.
But getting back to Forever People, we have, you know, a lot of the issue plays out. We just get to see the individual members of the group and their torturous situations. And I mean, I found it's pretty chilling just because you have the, like, any kind of physical torture is one thing, but from their perspective, like, you have Moon Rider, who's kind of like the leader of the Forever People. He's in a glass box.
Yep.
And as far as he knows, he's screaming. He says, "What's wrong with you? I know you can hear me through this opening. Why do you just sit and stare?" So he knows, like, they're reacting to the noise he's making, but he doesn't realize all they're seeing is what looks like a, you know, a silly rubber skeleton making a scary noise, you know?
In the tunnel of mystery.
In the tunnel of mystery. So, and then we get Big Bear.
Big Bear stuck in the little window.
He's like in one of those
shooting galleries.
Shooting gallery games. These people think they're just shooting at a robot bear, a literal bear. And to him, it looks like they're shooting at him, and it actually causes him pain. So it's like there's, in addition to the physical torture, there's this mental torture of knowing that you're being seen by people, but they're
out of reach.
For some reason, they're not reacting to you. They're not saving you. And I think one of the coolest setup we get is what he's got Beautiful Dreamer, the situation he has her in.
That's a little
pretty
creepy.
Devious. It's pretty creepy.
I like that one a lot too.
Yeah.
And then the other one was the roller coaster thing, which had affected two members of the Forever People.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's Viken and Simeon.
Seraphin.
Yeah. Seraphin is forced to stay awake and, like, basically kick a lever or a pedal so that Viken's head won't be chopped off by the roller coaster. Basically, like, he kicks the pedal in time and it drops down a platform so that Viken's head doesn't get caught off. So he's forced to kind of, like, in a, stay awake, in other words.
This issue was fucking brilliant. I think I like it even more now that we're discussing it.
It was, like, we always talk, it was my favorite this time. I just thought it was really, really creepy. The whole Beautiful Dreamer thing that we mentioned, you know, that we get a splash page, which is, I think Desaad, he's kind of creepily hanging over top of
makeup on her almost.
Yeah, he's and that's the creepiest he's ever looked.
Yep.
He basically puts her in a situation that the people on the outside think that it says win $1,000, whisper the magic word that awakes the sleeping robot princess.
Wait in line now. Yep.
And to her perspective, she's surrounded by monsters that are like, you know,
yep.
They're trying to say the magic word, but she thinks they're like growling and, you know, just making weird noises at her.
All these hideous kinds of Kirby monsters.
Yeah.
Just three eyes, fangs, the whole works.
But, things end up, you guys mentioned Sonny Sumo, if you want to talk about him a little bit, but he gets introduced, you know, one of the things that's so great about Fourth World, we're just always getting new characters, and this is the first appearance.
Every issue we get a first appearance of someone.
Practically, yeah.
It is fucking awesome. And the Mother Box was being tortured by Desaad, and Darkseid's looking at it like, you can't do that, that ain't gonna work. But the Mother Box ports itself away, and that's where Sonny Sumo picks it up. So we're introduced to Sonny Sumo, and we get a nice splash page of the Infinity Man. But goddamn, that issue is good.
Can I, first of all, some major props for, I need you guys to explain this to me because I'm not as well versed in all of this as you guys are. Dude, the design for the Black Race. Yeah, I know it's just a long jump skier modified, but so, you know, Kirby awesome. But the Black Racer, when he showed up after the the water guy died. I forget his name now. God.
Finn.
So he dies, and now all of a sudden you got this guy show up, and it's like, you know, he's an African-American guy, and he's skiing, basically, through the air in an awesome Kirby costume, and he's a paraplegic trapped inside of a paraplegic body. Now, I see him in this issue as well. What is his story up to this point? Is he just another one of the people from the Genesis here? Or is he just strictly like a neutral force that when a new god dies, he's going to show up, make sure that the body's taken care of the right way?
He is death.
He's basically death.
He's the Grim Reaper.
Okay.
Yeah, the last issue, I think it was the last issue of New Gods, is, if not, it was recently. I think we covered it last time. The Black Racer is, yeah, in this Kirby cosmology, represents death. And he came to Earth, and basically the soldier, the guy that's in the coma,
yep.
He kind of, the Black Racer, I kind of would like it to a situation where it's an entity that transfers hosts, almost kind of like the Spectre or something like that, where this guy, what's
the Spectre needed Jim Corrigan, he needed.
Right. So this Willie Walker, he remains in his coma state as far as like his relatives and family know and stuff, but he now is the host, basically body for the Black Racer. So he leaves for periods of time, and is kind of the harbinger of death. And it seems like, unlike other incarnations of death and other stories and stuff, you can avoid him. Like when we first meet him, he's chasing after Light Ray. Yep. Light Ray is able to avoid him and so avoids death. So it's not like, you know, the Reaper or something like that, where no matter what you do, you can't get away. So that's kind of like, so far, that's kind of the story with him.
He seems like a force for good, though. Like, I see him talking to Big Bear here, and he's like, now, we were brought here by unknown means in an unconscious state. All this was the result of invading the Gamma Tent of Godfrey, who preaches, and he's given them info. So it's like he's almost trying to be a force for good. So that's why I was confused. He's more like a neutral force than from what I'm hearing.
Yeah, he's neutral. His goal is just to take people to Valhalla or whatever.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, kind of like a force of nature, or you know, keeping a balance, I guess. More interested in balance or neutrality or something, I would think.
Okay, thanks. Perfect.
So yeah, and I think in this case he's just, he makes an appearance because of the death of Seagren, who
we've never seen before.
We never seen before.
Oh, you didn't? I thought he was, like, you know, well known. I'm like, oh man, I witnessed the death of Seagren. I thought I was watching something great.
No, we know he exists, and we know Orion knows who he is, but we've never seen him.
And then he has him attacked by giant seaweed.
It's the first and last appearance of Seagren.
A collective issue.
One thing that blew my mind in the opening of New Gods number 4 was, like, I'm currently reading on the side Devil Dinosaur. Kirby can draw the shit out of cavemen and dinosaurs, man.
Yes.
Oh my god. And you can see that like in 2001 A Space Odyssey by Marvel Comics too. But man, does he draw some good dinosaurs. And you have Mentron with a kid called Isaac, and they're on the Mobius chair, and they're back in time. They're witnessing the dinosaurs and the cavemen.
New Gods number 4. Incredible, man, Mike. Incredible.
Yeah, well, what me and Chris, I think we both agree on is that the concept art in New Gods is probably the best. Like, every panel seems to pop in New Gods. It's just amazing.
My notes here for New Gods number 4 are in all caps, and I never do that because it aggravates me. Awesome fucking Kirby monsters. And the second line is, it's a fucking Kirby monster showcase. And and I usually don't curse either. So I'm like, it completely blew me away.
Yeah, the opening splash pages are amazing. The two-panel splash page with the monsters and the cavemen is, God, it's beautiful.
It's jaw-dropping. It's the only thing you can call it.
Yeah.
Well, and you guys are talking about Final Crisis. It's kind of a has a connection to the very beginning of Final Crisis, right? Doesn't it start with Metron?
Yeah, in the caveman days.
Yeah, yeah.
And with Batman in the cave.
Yeah.
So you know what would be really interesting at some point? It is if we revisit Final Crisis.
Connect the dots?
Yeah, there's a lot of dots to be connected. And in Final Crisis, Simeon and Makari, they play a big, big part. And we've read the hell out of those two characters just recently.
Yeah, so...
And Grant Morrison admits in the prologues to these books that, like, he was kind of blown away by this. And that's why he... I think when he created Final Crisis, he started to try to think outside the box with these characters, like what Jack would have tried to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if we follow our 10-year rule, we can cover it in 5 years.
it's almost there.
So we can, it'll be like our 200th episode special or something.
Yeah, but we still got a lot of Omnibus.
Mike and Chris decode Final Crisis episode 200. Secrets are revealed.
I'm finding some true gems though in this podcast. I'm so glad that we started it because it's giving me an excuse to read stuff that I was normally just putting on the shelf. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And using as reference. And these things are, God, they're damn good.
And the time machines too. Like, just like some of the lines the women say, you feel bad for them and you understand woman's lib on a whole different level at that point. And then at another point, you understand some other social commentary. And Jackal just slipped that stuff in.
Yeah.
And not even know he's delivering. You don't even know it's happening to you. And it's like he's delivering these ideas. I'm just so... Every time I get into a new Kirby project, and I haven't read... You know his volume will work, guys. I haven't barely scratched the surface. And that's why I bought that Fighting American. And every time I'm like, man, this guy got screwed. How is he not recognized? And there's a push for a museum on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, a Jack Kirby museum. And if I can get you the address and the contact name, I'll do that. And then
that would be awesome to see.
We'll throw it in the show notes or something.
Because personally, to me, Jack, I hate to brush anything off, but he is the king to me. Like everything that he's done, I'm just blown away by his work. And even when he writes, he writes good. If you do early Marvel, you know he's not writing, but I think he is. I really do. I think Stan was scratching some plot points on a fucking sketch pad, and Kirby was writing the issue even though he was drawing it.
That was the Marvel way?
Yeah. You know? So now it was easy for him to adapt, I think, to being a writer because all he's doing is he's doing what he was doing in the past, but now he's filling in the words.
You know what, though? I think I look back. I look now at a situation of, I forget if it was this podcast. I listen to so many guys, but well, not so many, but Steve Ditko, like, he was doing Spider-Man, and it got to the point where Stan would just give him Spider-Man fights a lizard guy. And Ditko would come up with the entire story. He's got an arm missing. He makes a formula, blah, blah, blah. Tells Stan what, and all Stan does is fill in the dialogue. And also, yeah, I don't want to undercut what Stan did, but when you talk about story specifically, the story was done by the artist at that point. And then finally, when Stan says, legally on a written piece of paper, I consider Steve Ditko to be co-creator of Spider-Man, Ditko was still insulted because Stan used the word consider instead of Steve Ditko was the co-creator of Spider-Man.
Yeah, I think at the time they didn't realize how much of the story they were doing. And yeah. I think as time went on and the Marvel style faded, then they were like, holy shit, we were doing two jobs.
Yeah. Well, and you also, at the time, they're doing work, they're paying their bills, they're making, you know, they're just trying to make a living. You know, you'd have to be a futurist to foresee that, you know, these characters would be, you know, responsible for, you know, multiple motion pictures bringing in, you know, hundreds of million dollars, you know, 60 years down the road, you know?
Yeah, they could have never foresaw how much money that was bringing in.
No way.
Because, yes, we had serials like Captain Marvel and Captain America, which I doubt Stan Lee or Jack Kirby saw, or Joe Simon saw much from the Captain America serial.
Yeah, no, he used to say, Stan Lee, the story is, and I might have even heard it from you guys, Stan Lee says the story, people would ask him at a party, you know, what do you do? Well, I'm a publisher. And he would walk away, and they'd follow him over, and they'd go, well, what do you publish? And he'd say, magazines. Then he'd walk away. And then the people would follow him over. Oh, really? What magazines? Oh, I do comic books. And then the people would walk away.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't looked on as
it was
as,
like, the children's books.
Yes.
You're writing children's books.
But when things took off, I mean, that it's not that Stan Lee doesn't deserve credit. It's just that the credit that he's received at times haven't been wholly accurate. And one of the things that you can't say that he had nothing to offer, but one, the thing that he really did was to be a publisher. You know, he offered a lot when it came to popularizing Marvel Comics.
And making kids excited about Marvel Comics.
Getting into,
he was the promotional engine to the success and the vision of the Marvel Comics.
Because things did change in the 60s. You know, you had where it did become, you know, okay if you're a college student to have some Marvel Comics, you know, in the 60s when they started to deal with different issues. And, I mean, it might look dated to us today, but at the time, they seemed really, like, hip and interesting, you know. But if you read, like, comic book history of comics, you know, when Kirby was already aware of Stan Lee before they even started to work together in the 60s.
Because Christopher Lee used to run Atlas, right? Or he was a honcho there or something like that, right? Wasn't he?
You know, I'm not sure the exact, but they had encountered each other prior to working together in the 60s and creating Fantastic Four. And Kirby even then was reluctant to go back and work with Stan Lee because of the reputation that Lee had. And he knew, you know, he had, but he had basically kind of screwed Kirby over already in the past. So he was reluctant to work with him, but due to the nature of the business at the time and where the work was available, he was convinced to go work with Marvel and create Fantastic Four and everything like that. But later when, you know, he left Marvel and went to DC and created what we're talking about today, it was kind of something he had foreseen from the beginning as a possibility that he would end up, you know, not getting the credit that he deserved.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
I would have hated to just seen Jack like Steve Ditko is in an office, won't answer the door. And if he does, he's using the original pages from the first issues of Spider-Man as coasters for coffee cups. I mean, it's like, oh, God.
Yeah.
But I would have hated to see that happen to him. But I would have loved to see Jack Kirby in some of these movies, like to have Stan in for a cameo. Have Jack in for a cameo, you know? It's like...
You know what I'd love to see, and I don't know if this even exists, but like a movie that goes to, you know, like a major motion picture that's based on the lives of some of the comic creators, and it involves, you know, some of the key people that did Marvel and DC. I think it would be freaking interesting because the novels read really interesting. Like if you read like the Stan Lee one or the Jack Kirby one, they're pretty freaking interesting.
Give me a guy. You're going to say Kirby. We're going to say Kirby and Stanley as naturals, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to say the creator of Batman. God, I am
losing my mind. Bob Kane?
Yes. I would have put him in there because he's controversial. You don't know exactly where the line is drawn. And I would throw Carmine Infantino in that mix.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot you can throw in there. Bob Kane was like a business genius because... Man, he like formed an art team that mimicked his style, and he sat back and cashed in, I think.
Yep. And then you do Simon & Schuster.
Yeah.
And there you're done.
Yeah, it would be absolutely a great thing for me to watch. And
that would be
I don't know if it would sell millions, but I would love to watch it happen.
Me, you and Chris would be the only guys at the theater.
Yeah, I don't think it would appeal to the mass, but people do know, like, if you promoted it right, like, learn about the creator of the Fantastic Four and, you know, the Iron Man and stuff, it'll draw people.
Well, I think that's what you'd have to do. Like, you could probably greenlight it and sell it as like a, you know, like an art house picture.
Yeah.
Based on the appeal of, you probably would, right now, you'd probably have to go with Marvel.
And find the backdrop of World War II?
Yeah, or maybe, you know, base it off of the recent, you know, the Secret History of Marvel Comics, that book that came out recently, tie it into that, you know, but just capitalize off the popularity of the Avengers and all that right now. Like, you know, see the secret story behind characters and stuff like that, and kind of focus it in on all that. But yeah, I mean, you have,
it would be an Academy Award nominee.
For me, if I was in charge, it would
Al
win.
Pacino at no Robert De Niro and Al Pacino
and Jack Kirby. That would be awesome.
They'd have to be there later, lad. Those guys are getting up there themselves.
Yeah, they are.
They'd have to be a story of their last years.
Ripped to Horror Production. Quick, Mike, grab the script by Monday.
That'd be awesome if I could change my career and make that happen.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, we better get back onto the
news. All right, yes, get back on track. I'm sorry, guys. You will get derailed by me once in a while.
So what really happens is this the death of Seagrin and Orion, the cop, is with his buddy cop, and they find Seagrin, and Orion's like freaking out the other cops because he's like explaining a bunch of shit that they don't even know what he's talking about. They like put this crazy guy into the asylum. So this deals with Inner Gang, a lot of what's going on with Inner Gang. And the Black Racer actually shows up. And if this is your first intro to the Black Racer, it's a little confusing probably because he's just flying back to the hospital where Willie is.
Dude, yeah, when he showed up, I thought it was awesome. When he made it into his appearance, I thought it was awesome. I'm like, who is this cool guy? All of a sudden, he doesn't say a word. He just flies into the freaking body, and the sister's there saying, I thought I took precautions against fire because there was some kind of mist, because when he turned back to the paraplegic, he, I guess there's some kind of pyrotechnic or some kind of effect, but...
And yeah, what was interesting... Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that, I mean, his appearance, I think, basically is just because of the death of Seagrin. But the issue itself deals more with Orion making use of the four humans that he's been with since he came to Earth. The ones that, you know, he saved from Apocalypse and brought back. You know, Lincoln and a couple of other guys. And Lincoln is the guy that poses as a detective along with Orion.
His partner.
Yeah, it's kind of like a partner and stuff like that. And they basically come up with a scheme that if they're going to, since they're dealing with Inner Gang, they're going to sort of create the impression that there's this Orion gang, O'RYAN, that is moving into their territory. So, you know, Orion gets sort of encourages and recruits these humans to help him with his plan, you know, even though they're only normal humans, you know, he kind of trains them and encourages them and comes up with the plan to try to take down Inner Gang.
I do like in this one how they like kind of go undercover and they put that Victor Lanza guy, the insurance executive, who of all of them has the least amount of courage. He's kind of like the cowardly lion. Yeah. So they actually go undercover to Inner Gang, and he's kind of the front.
Yeah, well, what I thought was interesting was that they actually. Orion calls them all together to concentrate on the mother box to see if they can figure out why they can't find the Apocalyptians, if I'm saying that correctly, Apocalyptians, and they came up with a guy named Snakey, and they figure out the pool hall that Snakey's at, so mother box can't find where the problem is, but that's the guy that you got to go find.
It's because Inner Gang has a technology called the jammer.
The jammer,
and
right?
It's jamming their frequencies and the ability to find certain things, so they have to find the jammer and take it out.
It's your like beautiful tendency of Kirby to mash genres, because it's almost like a sci-fi story mashed with like a 60s cop show or something like that. It's like Lost in Space meets Streets of San Francisco or something.
I think it more of like a mobster one, like Godfather meets 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes, I don't care. You will now think of my name only in its Earth term, Orion. That was awesome.
And that, because I like it's like, well, that'll be easy because it sounds the same.
One of my notes is some of the dialogue is hysterical.
You know, well, he addresses it. He said, I know it's like, he basically says, I know it sounds the same, but in your mind, you have to think of me as Ryan in case anyone reads your mind. It's like, okay, at least Jack knows what he's doing here.
And you know what's cool is when the guy walks in, you know, the insurance guy, he walks in to make a deal or whatever. That one guy from Inner Gang is like getting ready to shoot some guy that's tied to a chair, and he's doing it with the fishing rod on the gun's trigger.
Yep. Nature boy, country boy. Country boy. Yeah, the guy basically uses his pipe. One of the forever people uses, I don't know the guy's name, uses his pipe. I think it might be that Viking guy to trick Snakey into showing them where the mansion is. And then the girl, tricks Intergang into letting the entire gang into the their hideout that doesn't stick out like a sore thumb. It's like whole coastline, and then this huge mansion in the middle of nowhere, and that's it. Stuck. So,
but so, yeah, their whole deal is they're trying to find the jammer, right?
So, yeah, and they actually destroy it.
And it's they got
the guy was bragging,
right? And they got one of those like mounted fish on the wall. That's like where that's the lever. You got to turn the fish, and that's what like makes the wall slide.
Yep,
slide over. Yeah, like the secret trout. So, and that's the cue for Orion, O-R-I-O-N, because he's all dressed up in his New Gods gear to swoop in on his astro glider and blow the shit out of the jammer.
Which allows him to go find out who killed Seagrin, which allows him to go to the Deep Six.
Yeah, because he actually, in addition to the jammer doing what it's named, jamming signals, there's actually like a hidden passageway behind it. So when he blasts it and busts through, he finds himself down situation like underwater, and he finds the Deep Six who
I don't know what happened.
Yeah, you're back.
Yep. Oh, okay.
I was asking you, the guy tricks him into showing him the jammer because the guy says, "Oh, you think your gang is tough? Look at the hardware my gang has." And he turns to Trout and freaking this whole technology's behind it. And what's the guy's name? Lanza?
Lanza, yeah.
The insurance Lanza guy.
Pretending he's Orion, the boss of the gang.
Yeah, he acts like he's not impressed. He's
he does throw a fucking punch, though. He knocks the shit out of that dude.
Yeah,
he gets his, he finds his courage.
His balls.
Yeah. That's what I was about to say.
They were behind the trout. The trout had his balls.
But,
and let's have a hand for Orion's bike. I mean, can we really? I'm sorry. I know it's been around for a while, but that thing is badass.
Astro glider.
Yep.
So the ending is basically one of those endings where we see the hero looking off panel and his eyes get wider and he's frightened and you can't even imagine what he's looking at because he's so frightened.
They get attacked by giant seaweed because of the Deep Six guy down there that he finally finds the tunnel and he finds a guy named Slig, the dog of apocalypse, he calls him. And mm-hmm. Slig wraps him in deadly seaweed. And Chris said it perfectly. It's like you can't believe what he's seeing. Don't miss Spawn. I wonder how much they paid McFarlane to get Spawn in the next issue.
I'm sure it wasn't cheap.
Yeah, that's when they started making big bucks. If you can buy the Maguire ball, that's costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
So yeah,
that's part of our misinformation service. You know, in the 1970s when Image Comics started,
So our final issue is
a great issue. I'm so glad you guys I would have never read this if it wasn't for your show, because I had thought I had known what the fourth world was. I understood the concepts of the two different worlds, one good, one evil, you know, the good son Orion, dark side, and all of that stuff. But now that I'm into it, forget it. I'm going to go through this whole thing.
Yeah, it's one thing to talk about it and listen to people talk about it, but it's another thing to actually experience it.
Oh, unbelievable.
It opens your eyes to so much. And that leads us into Superman's Pal, the new Jimmy Olsen, and it's got Don Rickles on the cover.
Right on the cover. In black and white process, Mr. Rickles, held by the Golden Guardian, is the guy's name?
Yeah.
Yep.
And Supes. with Goody Rickles in the background, which I thought was strange that there was a guy named Goody Rickles that looked just like Don Rickles, but he's a good guy.
Yeah, he was kind of an. I think Chris and me thought he was kind of annoying in the last issue.
He was. He had appeared then.
Yeah, he at least makes a little bit of humor in this one.
He's not as bad in this one, but yeah, I think last time I called him the Jar Jar Binks of the fourth world.
Yeah.
And once again, I go back to the cover. Who are they marketing this to?
Don Rickles fans, I guess.
This was Jack Kirby's. We read in the prologues that Jack Kirby wanted to do the fourth world, and DC says, okay, you could do the fourth world, but you're going to have to take over a property that we tell you to take over. And they gave him Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen. So this is probably Jack Kirby saying, well, here's my middle finger.
It all makes sense to me.
You're going to make me write Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen? Well, here's Don Rickles, motherfucker.
Right on the cover. That's awesome.
You know, it does look like they're actually, the way that they're holding the picture, of it's like a sphere. It's like a circle with Don Rickles' face, and it looks like they're actually running with a battering ram, so it's like a Don Rickles battering ram right up the ass of the reader. It's like they're storming Apocalypse with a Don Rickles face.
Oh, that's fun.
Battering ram.
And we were talking last night on DC Noise about, you had mentioned briefly, like, some of these panels were blowing you away because you remember seeing some of them in Fantastic Four.
Yes. I had turned a page on this, and the first page shows Clark Kent stuck in a little, you would call it an escape module, if you could imagine, like from Star Wars, with 3PO and R2 escaped in a little pod, gliding through space, and all of this space stuff in the background, and it's actual photos, but the way that they're colored and the way that they're composed, it's just so otherworldly, yet set in, like, you could imagine and say, you know what? That's what it would look like out there. And it just blows you away. The first page, the second page is complete like that with all kinds of space junk floating around. And then they start with the traditional comics again. But just blows you away. This style, you don't see this enough. I guess it's because Kirby has made it his own and nobody else really can use this kind of stuff anymore. I mean, it just blows you away.
I kind of suspect it was partially done out of necessity because his contract page-wise was so high. But that said, I think it's like one of those situations where if you're an artist and stuff and you got to get your work done, it's like either you half-ass it or you find a creative way to save time that still looks good, you know, and I think that's the case here. It's like he made the best of the situation and found a creative way to save himself some time, you know.
True. Give it some of these ships, it's like they could exist back in the 60s, 70s. You could see them. It's like some of them look like Russian ships and U.S. satellites and stuff. And they probably are. You know, it's probably stock footage you got from someplace, stock shots you got from.
Well, it, you know what it seems to me is like a collage of photos that he puts together and merges them together like a mosaic picture and then puts colors over them. And there's really a lot of art behind this photo because it's like random shots of craziness. Like in one of the ones where they were in the super cycle or whatever, we were going through a panel where you were seeing skulls and all this anatomy. It was just crazy shit. And now it looks very sci-fi, but this is freaking phenomenal. This issue was kind of funny to me. So Clark is in this ship. They launched him into space last issue because Morgan Edge wants to take out Clark. He wants to take out Jimmy Olsen. He wants to take out Goody Rickles just because I think he's an annoyance to him.
Right.
And he launches Clark into space, so he's going into space. The other three were dealt with by Inner Gang, and in other words, they invited him over to dinner. They ate, and they had a chemical in them that would make them spontaneously combust within 24 hours. So Guardian, Jimmy Olsen, and Goody Rickles are trying to find a cure so they don't spontaneously combust, while Clark is in space wondering if he's ever going to get home.
And Goody Rickles calls the chemical pyroglacamora.
Glacamora, yeah.
And Golden Guardian corrects him. So it's actually pyrogranulate.
And here's where Guardian kind of looks like Cap, because Guardian's kind of like... He was in this, you know, lab, and he works with the DNA and all this crap.
He was cloned, basically.
He was cloned, and now he's, like, free. He's in Metropolis. He's able to run and jump buildings and all this stuff, and he's like, wow, this is like, I have a sense of freedom that I've never experienced before. And he's chasing Mannheim, or whatever that guy's name, of Inner Gang, because they're like in a Winnebago. Speeding Winnebago. Yeah. And he's chasing them from the rooftops.
Yep.
Because Mannheim's the one.
The ugly.
Responsible for getting them. He tricked them into eating food that had the pyrogranulate in it.
Mannheim has played a big part in the DC universe, like, especially in Jerry Ordway's Adventures of Superman. And, like, we did see him, if I remember correctly, in Young Justice, too, so. He's been animated.
Yeah, it's interesting how the fourth world has become... It's a part of the DC universe at large, but there's the Superman connection because... And it all kind of just goes back to the fact that DC made Kirby take on Jimmy Olsen. So you had Superman involved, and Superman's going to help sell the books and stuff like that, but... And Kirby said, okay, if I have to do Jimmy Olsen, I'm going to tie it into the fourth world. But as a result, you have, you know, a lot of this fourth world stuff and whatnot has just been associated with Superman over the years. And other writers have made the connection even stronger, I think, with, you know, Darkseid in some ways being considered at times more of a Superman villain, even if now he's kind of just like a DC Universe villain.
And I had read a comment about that. Someone was saying, why is Darkseid the Superman villain? Well, it's kind of originated that way.
Yeah.
Who else is going to fight Darkseid, really? You know what I mean? You got to have him up against the most powerful DC hero. And not for nothing, reading this book, you just know it's Cap. This is a Cap book, basically. And I don't say that denigrating. It so fills my heart with joy to see it's like Cap panels I'm looking at here. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, so like this Golden Guardian's a clone of the original Golden Guardian. You know, just like we have the Newsboy Legion in the fourth world are the sons of the original Newsboy Legion. And the Newsboy Legion and the Golden Guardian had a connection in their 40s characters, you know, even predating.
Right.
So the Golden Guardian is kind of like a contemporary creation of Captain America, or at least around the similar time. But yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, like a couple pages in after the splash page, it has Golden Guardian, Goody Rickles, and Jimmy Olsen. And you have in the middle of the page... the Golden Guardian in the foreground rushing forward, you know, that's a total Cap.
It is Cap, yeah, absolutely.
And you know, so yeah, there's definitely some real similarities there.
So that's another reason I was hooked into this. I told you, I was hooked into this completely, this series.
Well, yeah, we get a better idea of if you didn't know already, you get a better idea of what Don Rickles' shtick is. Because last time he's mentioned, but we only get his lookalike Goody. But the real thing shows up at the news station, and you know, he's an insult comic, if you want to describe it in two words.
Sign this, Don. Write something weird and nasty.
Yeah, everybody wants to be in Salt Lake.
Just a quick side note, guys. He killed his career on live television just recently. So,
recently?
Yeah, he killed his career. They had mercy on him. They didn't plaster it all over the place. But he said something really racist about the president. And racist, if he had said it back in the 70s, nobody would have blinked an eye. But because he said it today, because he said it like a week after the president became the president, he's done. He was pulling in six figures a week in Vegas every week.
Are you serious? Because I really...
Absolutely.
I mean, you say six figures a week recently?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow, that
six figures a night. I'm sorry,
He's got to be like... He's got to be in his 70s or late 70s.
Yeah.
Late 70s. He must be pretty healthy then.
He's pretty fat now, but him and Larry King were good friends. What he said was, and it, you know, in a context of racial things, it's bad. It's politically incorrect, but it was just in poor taste and it killed his career. His contract got canceled, from what I understand. He said, oh, now we got a black guy in the office. Imagine if we're having a nuclear war. All the Russians got to do is throw him a basketball. And that was it. Nope, you know, nobody laughed in the room. And he did it on that, not the one Colbert, the one that's before it. I keep forgetting what the one that's on before Colbert and Comedy Channel. And that was it. He killed his career finally after all of those years. And a shame. But, and I know
when you're an insult comic, it seems like a lot of their careers get hurt by something they say. Like, Dice Clay was a big guy, and he said something, too.
Yep.
And that kind of destroyed his career.
Yep.
So. Well, and it's the nature of insult comedy's changed over the years. I mean, he, as far as killing his career, I mean, at this point, it's kind of like the legacy of a career. Like, even he's making money. If he was making money, he's making money off of, like you said, he's working in Vegas, which in the big Vegas part of headline. Working in Vegas is, you know, that's... Yeah, but yeah, that's like you go to Vegas and you headline in Vegas, you know, when you're older, and yep. You know what I mean. He's actually 86.
So yeah,
he's
see,
even older than that. So, but I mean, he's kind of like a man out of time at this point, right? You know, because it's just him.
Yeah,
his whole shtick, like you said, set in the 60s, the 70s. You know, insult comedy, the nature of it was you insulted everybody, and the way that you insulted them didn't matter as long as you were an equal opportunist, you know?
Exactly.
But now, guys and girls that work in that...
You can't do that.
There's certain things that are off limit nowadays. Like, if you're like a Lisa Lampanelli or somebody like that, you know,
I laugh.
She's an example of an insult comic today. You know, and they still have their, there's people that are still going to be offended by them naturally, but there's certain things that are off limit nowadays. And, you know, it's probably a situation of a guy, he's 86 years old. I mean, he's, you know.
If I could sign up for 86 right now, I would, believe me.
Yeah. But, yeah, you see him kind of doing his thing here in the comic book, he gets hugged by a large woman, and he tells her to go out and sit on the Chicago Bears.
You run away with locomotive, he calls her.
Calling people, so it's like PG Don Rickles, you know, calling people dum-dums and, you know, savages.
Oh, we got an Asian here. Put the bayonet down. The war's over. Didn't anybody tell you that that's what he would do? That was his whole shtick. And
The other thing about like you say he's 86, and I'll just say this because, you know, I have my grandparents and stuff. Mm-hmm. Seemed like the older they got, the less they cared about being politically correct.
Yes.
So he might be caught in that too, like...
Mm-hmm.
Where he just wasn't thinking, and I don't know. Yeah. It's not defending what he said. I'm just saying that it seems like a barrier when you hit a certain age. The one thing that would prevent you and your brain from saying stupid things, the barrier kind of comes down.
Hey, I may not even wake up tomorrow.
It's like, I don't give a fuck. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's that, and it's like... It's also just being from a different generation. I mean, it doesn't totally affect it, but like once, you know, with my own grandparents, they're not going to have the same level of racial sensitivity that I do. You know what I mean? But there's like, so if you want to, like in a technical sense, like on a, like by a dictionary definition, some of the things that come out of them would be considered racist, but you wonder, you know, like what the motivation behind it is, you know.
Spirit. It's the spirit of the comment, really, you know, too. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, what's behind it, you know. But,
Yeah, so they loved him. Don Rickles was very popular. Like I said, headlined in Vegas for many years, did movies, did television shows. He was in Kelly's Heroes. I don't know if any of you guys saw that. Mike, that was from your time. You might have seen that one.
I don't remember Kelly's Heroes.
Clint Eastwood, and they were going after gold shipment behind German lines. But anyway.
Did that have... Telly Savalas?
Yes, it did.
Okay, so I do remember it. I did see it, but God, it was a long time ago.
Yeah. So
when you said Kelly's Heroes, the first thing that came to my mind is Telly Savalas.
Yep. Yeah, he was in that movie too. So Don was pretty big, but I don't know if he was ever as big as Jack was portraying. I mean, they got him swarmed like Elvis here. Please, Don, look out. Don't stand on his hand. He won't be able to sign any more autographs.
He almost looks like this chick will give him, you know, that he'll get laid over here. The secretary from Morgan Edge.
Who's no slacker, let me tell you.
No.
Yeah, I think he was pretty, I mean, he was big enough that he was before my time technically, like his heyday, but growing up and, you know, I one way or the other ended up knowing who he was through just like different appearances, or you hear people talking about him and stuff
and his
like
face
that.
Well,
you
know?
Dean Martin's roast, he was big on too. He would do. I don't know if you ever saw that, but he was big on that too. Every episode.
But yeah, people say Kirby can't draw women, but Morgan Edge's secretary.
She got it going on.
Miss Conway is no slouch, and Don Rickles says, "You're great, honey. You're wasted here. You deserve something better than a typewriter and this sneaky crumb. Get yourself a bikini and start a chain of heart attacks at a garden party."
That was great.
But him and Morgan Edge start their meeting and everything like that, and we get this is the first time Light Ray has ever shown up in Jimmy Olsen. He's been pretty much in New Gods at this point, but he shows up. And Clark Kent's in the spaceship that Clark Kent is trapped in to give him an assist just in time for a bunch of Darkseid's parademons to show up and attack. And these guys, they're kind of Darkseid and Apocalypse. They're kind of like his base infantry almost. Mm-hmm. You know, we see them given a new look. In the New 52 and the first Justice League story, but you know, here they're pretty much like orange goblin looking orc looking people with wings and like green pants. But and then we get like some more comedy because we switch back to Jimmy Olsen and Goody Rickles are stuck in a crowded subway train, and Goody is starting to get anxious and freak out because of the he's worried about dying from the pyrogranulate, and it's like he's accelerating its effects by freaking out. It's like
he says he might be accelerating it, but he's like, I ate more than you guys.
And you, hockey puck, can't you read signs? They say no smoking in this car. I can smell you, man. And they're smoking.
Yeah, if you didn't know they were in New York City yet, that makes it clear here.
And he's got everybody laughing. He's like, I can't believe this. I'm dying and I'm getting laughs.
You know, it's funny because it's like, if this, when I was reading this, I was thinking, if this is a TV show, you know, it feels like a TV show because it's like the total thing where you'd have a guest actor on and they would play two different roles, you know?
Makes sense, yep.
Don Rickles would be playing himself, and he'd also be playing Goody Rickles, because they're both, like, doing comedy, but Goody Rickles' comedy is more of, like, the neurotic, like, Jerry Lewis kind of style comedy. So I just kind of thought it was funny, because it's drawn, it's a comic, but it's almost like he's playing both roles.
All right, they're still going to put him in as many panels as possible.
Yeah. But Guardian starts taking out Mannheim and his people.
The Guardian finds the minibus, finally.
While that's going on, Goody and Jimmy finally make it.
That page, yeah, on the lower right-hand corner where it says he's deflecting our fire with his shield spread out. He can't cover all sides.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that cap panel at least 60 times if I've seen it once. And it just gave me joy to see that. I'm like, that is such a cap panel. It's awesome.
Yeah, I like, because he's leaping, his body's kind of compressed in half, and he's leaping right between all the bullets, definitely.
Even Kirby's guns, you know, they're nothing that existed in this world, but they look mean.
Mm-hmm.
More technical than a regular gun.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know that they have full of bad intention, and it's just one of those other things that Kirby does great. He does them weapons, the shit. There's not a thing he does bad. I'm sorry. I'll say it.
Well, it probably helps. Like, throughout the Fourth World, there's always a thing about how they're getting their technology from Apocalypse. So it's different technology. It's not Earth. They're not Earth weapons and stuff like that. And what's nice for Kirby is that he can just make it up then. You know, he doesn't have to.
In the organ, in the tent, Godfrey's tent. You can use. That was full bad intention.
Yeah, so I mean, he can kind of invent it, and that way it also saves him time because he doesn't have to use reference.
True.
You know,
I'd rather him do it.
Probably helps him save time.
What comes out of his mind is better than what exists in reality. And I know this sounds like a love fest, but I don't care. I don't get a chance to talk about Kirby enough, and that's why I wanted to come on the show. I'm sorry. So
that's okay. And like, the Mike Myers network of podcasts, like, were the ones that sort of counterbalance the trash that Kirby takes on DC Noise from Keith and Daryl.
I don't know what's wrong with those guys.
I understand that.
But, yeah, I mean, this
Silver Bond page is right here. Every friggin' panel, it's right here. It's amazing.
Yeah, so they actually arrive at Morgan Edge's office, you know, Goody Rickles and Jimmy Olsen. They're like, we're fucking dying. We're going to self-destruct in just a few minutes. We need a cure. And that's when Goody and Don Rickles meet for the first time. And they're, like, amazed at how the resemblance is so close.
And you knew that had to happen at some point.
Yeah. Worlds collide.
You sound like Keith now. His world is colliding. And it's funny because Goody's the one with the costume on.
It seems like Morgan Edge's reaction is like he just doesn't want to die when they self-destruct. So he's like, you know, he calls for help. He's like, get the bomb squads in here right now.
Oh, yeah, he's a slime bag. I mean, he's not even, you know, like we saw it before. He's
not there to help him. He's like,
a corporate scumbag.
I just need I need to protect myself. Set these guys off.
Get out. Get the bomb squad. I'm leaving.
And then luckily the Guardian crashes through the window with the antidote and he gives it to him. And it tastes a lot like it tastes pretty good.
He said
it's like cheap wine.
Wine or something, yeah.
And what's beautiful is that, you know, the bomb squad shows up. They start to tell him, you know, false alarm, you know, because, and Don Rickles is like, no, not false alarm. I'm the bomb. I'm the human bomb. Get me out of here.
Wrinkles. Anything. Get me out of here.
Get me the hell out of here.
And when everything gets quiet, Clark comes through a boom tube. It's like
conveniently
boom. Shows up in Morgan Edge's office because Light Ray rescued him from having to go to Apocalypse and just boom tubed him out of there.
Yeah, for some reason, the way that he drew Clark Kent's posture coming out of the boom tube, the way his like arms are stretched out and his legs are kind of, you know, bent. It just it just cracked me up for some reason. It's like all of a sudden just, you know, ta-da. Like, you know, that for a reporter, that guy's got pretty good posture.
Hmm. Here's what aggravated me.
He seems like a natural.
Finally, you think you finally got him, the little weasel Morgan Edge. We got him, finally. Clark says, nice to see you too, Mr. Edge. We learned quite a bit from the assignment you gave us. It was dangerous, but highly intriguing. Fine, Kent, we'll discuss it later, like trying to dismiss him. And Jimmy says, how about now, Mr. Edge? I know Clark wouldn't mind. And then right then the bomb squad comes in and saves Edge from having to explain. I'm like, God damn it, he gets away with it again.
Nicely plotted, though.
Yeah, yeah, so those were all pretty good issues, man. I enjoyed them.
Now, there are, I would imagine, on the internet, scores of reading orders of this. Is there one you go by specifically, guys?
Oh, we're going by the omnibus order.
By the omnibus
it's order. The omnibus order is the order of publication.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're reading off the newsstand.
Yeah. And see, that's the other thing. If it was bannered today, you would know they all kind of coincide. But back then, you had no idea, you know? Oh, they got a couple of new books out. I'll try this one maybe. And then if you're lucky, you figure it out. But there was nothing pointing you. Well, I guess maybe the letter pages and the ads. Do you guys get the ads in yours?
No.
Okay.
But I have the originals, so I have the ads. All the Kirby books, like past, I think from 73 on, I have, or from 70 on.
Okay.
And I'm still working on some of the stuff in the 60s. Like, I'm still working on my FF run. There's a couple in the FF I know I'll never get just because they're just too damn expensive. But like I have almost bits and pieces of FF like from 44 on. So I got quite a extensive Kirby collection.
One thing interesting at the back of this, Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen, 141, there's a self-portrait. I guess it's a self-portrait of Jack where he's, talking about, there's one of mine in this mag. Could be a classic from Boy Commando, Sandman, Manhunter, or the original Newsboy Legion. Everything is as it was, and he's showing a little bit about what the page looked like. I thought that was pretty cool looking. So that was just part of the ads that they showed. I thought that was awesome.
So that was our three books from the Kirbyverse, and they were all really good.
Thank you, guys.
I was going to make one comment as far as the whole not having a banner telling you the reading order and stuff. I think it was like this and, you know, books like this that actually led to that, because I don't think really prior to this you didn't really have the crossovers you did have were very intentional and, you know, only a few issues. You know, you had your like annual JSA, JLA crossovers, but you didn't like see that as often as you do today. And even I don't when think Avengers really saw it coming.
Even when Avengers first teamed with Defenders, you didn't have a banner.
No,
yeah,
but
I think it wasn't until later on.
Next part of the story in this issue.
Yeah. You would get that.
But I mean, this is unique and different in a sense, because it's like, you know, you had, like Mike said, I mean, technically the individual stories just go from, you know, New Gods 1, New Gods 2, New Gods 3. You're going to get the most out of it if you're reading all four of them. You're going to see the parallels. You're going to see how it crosses over. but it's not where, like, you know, the story in New Gods 3 continues in Forever People number 3 or something like that, you know?
Yeah, oh, she battered the hell out of this today. Forget about
oh,
it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. You know, but it's different in marketing in the 70s and the marketing today. And, you know, this is, because you're talking about this is before, you know, this is before Secret Wars. This is before Contest of Champions. This is before all that stuff.
Yep.
And in some ways, you know, may have helped lead to stuff like that, where you had these bigger stories being done. That not only did they, you know, extend beyond a single issue, they extended into several different titles, you know, and were just like an ongoing story that just went on, and you know, developed over time, you know.
At the back of this Superman's, Jimmy Olsen Superman's Pal, there's a Newsboy Legion reprint as well with the Guardian. Feature.
Oh, cool.
The original Newsboy Legion.
They also have an omnibus of that. The Jack Kirby, Joe Simon, Newsboy Legion.
See, I'm trying to cut down, Mike, and you're going to fill me up again.
Well, these omnibuses are just, they're phenomenal. And they're something that I will read again.
Yeah,
even if it's just to pull off the shelf to look at some of these great panels, you know what I mean?
I sold everything that I wasn't going to read again. I sold as far as my big hardcovers go, because to get to sell single issues is wasting your time. So I sold a bunch of omnibus. I ended up selling. Do you know I ended up keeping all of my absolutes because I'm going to read all of them again. And there were a few omnibus I kept as well because I was going to read all of them again. But out of all those omnibus that I sold, I can finally afford a brand new laptop now. So
did you get rid of the Cap omnibus?
Oh, no, I kept both Cap.
I was shocked if you got rid of those.
Those have been read so many times. Oh, my God.
If anybody's interested, there is a Kirby Cap omnibus that's just Kirby.
No, I know. I already was looking at it, my friend.
Yeah.
I almost pulled the trigger on a Friday night. I swear to God, I saw him on the front cover. I'm like, oh.
I actually bought that one at Heroes, I think. It for 50% off, and I don't regret it.
It's going for $100 right now on eBay, from what I remember. Yeah, it's not cheap, but I will spend money for that one. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a good idea to jump on those omnibuses when they come out, because they don't always stay in print.
Right.
Or a lot of times they don't.
Well, that's I don't know if you guys needed a break or if you want to go directly into the mid cartoon piece. Do you guys need a break? Are you guys good?
I'm fine right now. I don't care. If anybody needs a break, I doesn't matter to me.
I'm good.
All right.
In the great hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe. Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, Aquaman, and those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Marshall, Will, and Holly, on a routine expedition, met the greatest earthquake ever known.
Thank you.
So our next topic is kind of like what Saturday morning cartoons meant to us as kids, and I think me and Steve are more towards closer age than Chris, but which is about a decade off, I think, from
yeah. Well, I'm grudgingly 47. I'm celebrating the I don't know what anniversary of my 29th birthday it is right now.
Yeah, I'm 43.
All right, so we're not far at all.
Yeah.
And,
Chris is a decade from me, but it's going to be interesting. But I just want to introduce it that, you know, cartoons were a big, big part of my life.
Me too.
I so much so that I didn't want to miss what was on, and I struggled with what to watch because it was on all three networks at the time: CBS, NBC, and ABC. And what I usually do, because I didn't have an alarm clock at the time, I would get up at like 4 a.m. and watch the color bars before cartoons started.
Yeah, yep, I've done that before.
I didn't have an alarm. I was like, God, I don't want to miss anything. It was like Christmas morning every Saturday. I don't want to miss anything. And the funny thing is that often left me falling asleep during the first cartoon because I'd get up and watch the color bars. And the color bars, you just turn on and you hear, ding. I can't believe my parents just let me do that. But
I knew you were going to sleep when your body needed it enough.
Yeah, sometimes I'd shut down during Johnny Quest. But
let me preface this by saying I got this idea for you guys because I read a book that I usually don't read. Now, I pick up some stuff from Tomorrow's Publishing, TWO, Morrow's Publishing. I know you guys know the publisher, in case any listeners don't know. And it's called Lou Scheimer, Creating a Filmation Generation. And he goes into a lot of it. And it started me thinking about back in the day and Saturday morning cartoons and all that. And I said, this would be perfect for Retrocast. That's why I recommended it for you guys. That I'm able to come on and talk about it. I want to personally extend a note of thank you and gratitude to each of you for allowing me this opportunity.
Glad to have you.
Yeah.
You're
coming with a lot more facts than we are. We're coming with more like a probably a personal experience, what it meant to us.
The thing with this was, and this wasn't something I was aware of, when network television first started, by law, it was required that they air 3 hours of children's programming a week, by law. Mm-hmm. Now, what they decided to do was take their weakest time slot and air it then, because they figured kids had no money to buy stuff. This was pre-He-Man, okay? Kids didn't have money to buy stuff. And if we have cartoon commercials, we'll sell them during that time. And they figured out that Saturday morning, all the adults were either hungover from Friday night or they're doing something that they couldn't do during the week. So we'll make it Saturday morning. So that's how we got that official 3-hour block per network on each network on Saturday morning. So, because Saturday morning was the weakest slot. And that's how that whole conglomeration of Saturday morning started. When they found out that there was money to be made there, those 3 hours turned into 5, 4, 5, 6 hours of television. It was insane. It was insane. And just like Mike with me, I would be up ready to go with my cereal, my blanket tent, and waiting for the first cartoon to come on. And
it was a real kind of stressful at the time too, because you'd have conflicts, and we didn't have a VCR.
No,
so it was like, holy shit, I got this and this, and like back in the day, TV Guide was like a big thing. Like the fall preview. Oh my God. It was like, I got to plan everything on Saturday morning. And sometimes I'd adjust it because I was like, I got to check out that cartoon.
And people don't understand, Friday nights, they would show previews of the upcoming lineup of Saturday mm-hmm. morning cartoons. They yeah. don't do that anymore. They used
even
to have,
for me. You know,
oh, you like,
yeah. I mean, well, even for me, like things started to decline in the 80s with Saturday morning cartoons, but they emphasis on the word started to, because it wasn't really, I mean, they were still a pretty big deal in the 80s for me growing up. And I remember, you know, there was at least a few years before we got a VCR. And I remember going over what's going to be the lineup for this year, just like they do with Fall TV now. Still, I remember going over the lineup and seeing, okay, you know, what am I going to watch on what channel, picking out, you know, from 8 to 8:30, I'm going to watch this show. And sometimes you had like a couple shows and you had to choose between one or the other, or you had a sister who, you know, you had to share with, and you had to end up watching Pound Pumpies because of her. You know, but you, if you had to share, so you had to make your choices, you know.
Oh, I would have went nuts. Oh, I'm an only child, but oh my God, I couldn't imagine. The quick Kirby tie-in, believe it or not. Lou Scheimer, the owner of Filmation, who you may have heard of the company Filmation. They have done, well, their most famous one to me is Star Trek, the animated series, was the first one written just using the real adult script writers, using the adult scripts that they would use for Star Trek, for the Star Trek series. His father in Germany actually did punch Hitler in the face.
Nice.
So he punched Hitler in the face before Kirby's Captain America did. So real life. But they did Shazam and Isis. They did. Those were two live action Saturday morning shows, actually. They did the Groovy Ghoulies. They did the Lone Ranger. They did Flash Gordon. They did, I mean, it's...
Oh, shit, I forgot. I forgot to put that one in my list, but Flash Gordon Animated was a big deal to me.
Doing Archie's Records for a while. They had the top three Saturday morning cartoons and the top three American singles. That's how much money that this company was making at the time. Mighty Mouse, all of that stuff. So,
and I think Filmation was successful because they were able to find a way to like make things on a cheaper budget too, right?
Me, it was Scooby-Doo. I had to see Scooby-Doo because I couldn't see Scooby-Doo on any other day.
Well, that was my top cartoon because even it is a, I was a Scooby-Doo fan, I think from like 73. I don't remember if it's 73 or 74. That's when I started watching cartoons like hardcore, around 73 or 74. And, Scooby-Doo, I watched and loved through every incarnation until Scrappy came.
Thank you.
And then I jumped the shark and I left. I like stuck around for maybe five episodes and I said, man, what the fuck just happened? I don't want to watch this anymore. But I would watch that one religiously. I mean, that was a key part of my mornings. And you went through various incarnations, and it was always the same formula. It was the same. These damn kids, they solve the mystery at the end. These things don't exist.
Snoopy kids.
Yeah, but sometimes you'd get team-ups, like with the Adam West Batman. And
that was the Scooby-Doo movies.
Yeah, you would get all kinds of characters that you've seen before teaming up.
Harlem Globetrotters, Adam's Family.
And guess what spawned out of Scooby-Doo? Dino-Mutt and Blue Falcon. I mean, that was the shit back in the day.
Yes.
I was like a huge fan of Dino-Mutt and Blue Falcon because Dino-Mutt was like just a robotic dog that would drive Blue Falcon kind of nuts, you know? How could you be a superhero with that dog? I don't know.
Scooby-Doo, I was always a big Flintstones fan because during the week, the Flintstones was always on. That was our first primetime television animation that moved to syndication during after school hours. And so when they came out with Pebbles and Bam Bam and then Captain Caveman as a side effect, I was hooked on that too. So I was done there. And it's like if I had to make a choice between those, forget about it. I didn't know what I would have done.
Yeah, I was like, Captain! It was Captain Caveman and the Teen Angels.
Well, and I got to fortunately, I got to experience a lot of the stuff that you guys saw on Saturday mornings moved into syndication. So, like, a lot of that stuff I would see after school or whatever. I mean, and I was a big Scooby-Doo fan, but I was a fan of the Scooby-Doo that you guys watched. I just saw them in reruns because they were still trying in the 80s to keep Scooby-Doo around, but they just went through one incarnation after another of reinventions. As far as the Saturday morning cartoons in the 80s went, they had, you know, a pup named Scooby-Doo and all these different things that they kept trying, but I always preferred the older episodes that I saw during the week, like you said, with the, I always loved like the different guest stars when they had, whether it was
the freak of the week,
Harlem Globetrotters or Phyllis Diller or whoever they had on that week. I always liked those ones, you know.
One of the best opening I love the opening to Scooby-Doo. I mean it.
With the bats.
Yeah.
It was, I knew I was in then. Yep.
Music, it was just awesome. Dun, 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 dun. Where are you?
That was a big one. A big one for me also was because it didn't talk down to me. At least I felt at the time it didn't talk down to me. Was Johnny Quest, which was also a Filmation production. I love Johnny Quest because it was an adventure tale.
It still holds up today, too, I would say.
You know, you're probably right. It's been years and years and years and years, decades probably, since I've seen an episode. But you're probably right. You're probably right. We don't have enough of that kind of entertainment these days for well, I'm going to say yes.
Kind of like it was just a different adventure every week.
Right.
It was his name Haji, Johnny Quest, Haji and Banner and Dr. Quest.
There was and another thing about Filmation that they don't get enough credit for. People of color and diversity. Filmation were always the pioneers in that, i.e. Haji, i.e. well, Star Trek gets more credit for Uhura, but it was another famous African-American one. What was his name? I can't remember. He was the actual leader of the gang. They did Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids, and they didn't do it like any kind of specific ethnic show. It was just a show about kids having a good time. It didn't matter where they were growing up. So what, they were growing up in the ghetto. It was just kids having a good time.
Yeah, that was one I would always catch. And the one thing I remember about Fat Albert, it was always later in the day. Do you know what I mean? It was always like 11 a.m. or 10:30 a.m. or towards when the cartoons were ending. So it was like the last cartoon I would watch.
The last thing that I – well, they also had the license for Superman. They did Super Friends for a while. I mean, they did Batman and Robin with the original cast. The thing about Filmation was – and here was the shame. And the triumph to a little bit. Here's what ended up happening before we get into a couple of more of our favorites was that when cable television hit, the law that said – every network has to have 3 hours of children's programming eased up because there were some cable networks that were strictly children's programming.
Right.
So they didn't have to.
Nickelodeon.
They didn't have to worry so much about kids being able to see something. And what was happening during all of this was Filmation was doing everything in-house in America. And all the other networks and companies, I should say, not networks, the company, animation companies, were farming stuff out. And it got to the point where a company would farm out stuff to Japan, who would then turn around and farm it out because it was cheaper in Taiwan, who would then farm it out because it was cheaper in the Philippines. So there was four different levels of people involved in the process, which is why you ended up with a lot of crap sometimes. So what Filmation did, their one big hit, they did, they said, let's do it this way. We'll do 100 and something shows. We'll do 3 years worth of shows for a network, a half hour or an hour a day, I forget what it was. And we'll call it He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. And it was right around that time I was just about getting old enough where I wasn't watching cartoons so much You know, it was more about Charlie's Angels for me than it was about Scooby-Doo. And we ended up losing, basically, the entire animation industry in the United States because Filmation couldn't hold out anymore. They had to fire everybody, basically. And
what year was that? Do you know?
Oh, I'm going to call it
89,
90. Yeah, I'm going to say 87, 88, like that. Okay. Yeah. I mean, they had the Archies. They had the Brady Bunch. They had, Fantastic Voyage was another one of my favorites that wasn't on long enough. That was based on a movie where you got shrunk down, shot into somebody's body, and you had to fight the antibodies and stuff. That was a great show.
Well, and that's, like I said, that the 80s is when things started to decline. That's kind of one of the things that happened. Like you said, shows like He-Man, G.I. Joe, and whatnot that were big for my generation, those were in syndication. You know, they altered the method of production. Like you said, they made a whole lot of episodes. And, you know, you mentioned the rise of cable television. One of the other things about that I read was one of the problems for these networks producing these shows for the Saturday morning on, you know, on your network stations were the FCC broadcasting rules were so strict you know, it was an additional production cost for them because they were always having to adhere to these very strict rules.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Nickelodeon, Cartoon Network, Disney Channel and stuff that started to spring up, they didn't have to worry about these rules. They were still making children's entertainment, but, you know, they didn't have to spend the extra time making sure, you know, that they fit all of their content into these, you know, the Byzantine structures of these rules.
Mm-hmm.
Other things, you know, it became cheaper for these stations to put on paid programming and public service stuff on Saturday mornings instead.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. They couldn't compete either, because all week long, these cable networks are developing this following unchecked. And Saturday morning came around, it became cheaper for them to run reruns of Head of the Class than it did for them to produce new animation. This Filmation company was trying to be the new Pixar, basically, since, like I was talking about the American industry, since then. Part of it has moved back to the United States because of the technology and the 3D rendering and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But, oh, God. I mean, the Hardy Boys. I mean, the list just goes on and on. The Josie and the Pussycats. And they would make songs, and then they'd make a show about the song just to sell the song, and it would sell! It was crazy.
But I had a couple other things, like, as far as just finishing up, like, what happened. A couple other things I jotted down was, you know, there was, and I think we probably all remember this, there was a lot of pressure on, like, you had said, Noob, that they figured out there was money in it. Well, that money started to become a little bit more difficult to make because there was a lot of pressure on the companies that were aiming all this advertising at children.
Yep.
You know, so they didn't, you know, you had public advocacy groups coming in and saying to, like, McDonald's and, you know, all these advertisers, hey, you gotta stop aiming all this stuff at children. It's not good for them, such and such. So some of that advertising money dried up. We talked about VCRs and not having VCRs. You know, that was another factor. You know, VHS tapes, later on DVDs. You could, you know, buy tapes of these cartoons and watch them whenever the hell you wanted to. You didn't have to, you know, wake up like Mike did and stare at, you know, the
color bars.
you could sleep in and then just watch the DVD, you know. And one other thing was just video games, obviously, as they became more popular. You know, you
bring up a point about legislation. I'm going to tell you that there was an out-and-out push after He-Man. Now, how He-Man came about was Mattel had the molds. They showed the molds to Filmation, and Filmation made the story. They made the story out of the molds. The story was not told to them by Mattel. Mattel had no interest in it. They had no creative interest in it other than the forms that you saw. And then the show was produced. And that's why it was one of the better ones. The networks got criticized heavily, like Nightline, like 60 Minutes. Like, they would be called to the carpet, and I forget what the organization was. It was like a MAD-type organization, M-A-D-D, that was against advertising for children and calling it cartoons. And meanwhile, that's not what Filmation was doing. A lot of the other companies were, i.e., and I'm sorry, I know we've got friends that love these properties, but like by the time they came out with shows like Transformers, like Micronauts, like even G.I. Joe, to me, they just looked like and felt like and commercials, and it looks like, it smells like, it walks like it. That's what it is. That's
what cartoons became, is like your success was based on the merchandise that you could sell from the cartoon.
Yep. And then
G.I. Joe was so successful, because it catered to a people that wanted to buy those action figures and He-Mans and Transformers. And
G.I. Joe's weird case, though,
they even say, though, that like cartoons today that might have decent ratings and can't sell toys are a reason why they're canceled.
Which I hate. This is what I hate about animation today. Batman, the last Batman series that was canceled. Was it the Brave and the Bold?
Yeah, the Fantastic series that Daryl hates. It's awesome. Yeah. This is one of the best cartoons ever.
Was great show, and they cancel that show. I don't know, the Avengers show also, Earth's Mightiest Heroes. They cancel that show. I mean, what are you people kidding me? Are you actually watching this? Things should be based. Cartoons should be based on the merit of the story and the characters, just like any other form of entertainment. And they're not. It's to the point where cartoons today are based, a lot of them, sadly, are based on, can I sell a Groovy Ghoulie action figure? You know, and I understand there's a place for all of that stuff, but it shouldn't be the reason for its existence.
Perfect world, but I mean, unfortunately, it always comes down to money. I mean, it is like other entertainment in the sense that, I mean, people are looking for a sure thing. That's why we get all these remakes and stuff like that, rather than, you know, they'll green light a proven property rather than some new IP, because it's all about the money, you know? And I think G.I. Joe, Transformers and stuff like that, it was about the toys, but the reason that we have like people like myself, like the Star Joe's podcast, a lot of the properties that they cover, are those kind of properties, that there was a strong toy connection. But those were like the cream of the crop, because for every one of those shows, you know, you had the problem is that you had a proliferation of them, and you had all these other shows where the quality and the ideas behind it wasn't good enough to last.
Snarks. Oh, Mike, I got a question for Mike. Did you watch Isis, Mike? Almighty Isis? And she would spin around. She was a professor, and she had the power of Isis. They used to show her right after Shazam.
I watched the Shazam live action. I mean, I included a couple live actions because there were a handful that I would always watch.
Yeah, it was superheroes, man. And plus she was smoking.
Yeah, she was smoking hot. And as goofy as, like, I don't know if I'd enjoy it now, but I enjoyed it at the time. You know, the Winnebago driving around from city to city and saying Shazam. But the the best live action one to me was Land of the Lost.
Yeah, you know what?
I fucking love that cartoon, and well, I would always watch that regardless of what was competing with it, because the Sleestaks and...
Oh, the Sleestaks scared the crap out of me.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Behind the couch.
But the other one that I watched that was live action was like the Croft Super Show. Do you remember that? With Dinah Girl, Dr. Shrinker, and all that shit.
Yeah, I remember H.R. Puffin stuff.
Yeah.
They had one, and it was ahead of its time. It was called Ark. It was called Ark.
Or I don't think I ever saw that one.
It was a big motorhome type thing. It was science fiction-y, and the world had been through an apocalypse, and it was very, very environmental. And for the time, it was ahead of its time, you know? It was all about the environment. Oh, this guy's polluting, and we have to stop it before... But yet it was apocalyptic, you know? So,
my live action one was, all mine obviously be after your guys' time, but my live action was Saved by the Bell was kind of, yeah, like on the first couple seasons of it were, when I was still watching stuff on Saturday mornings, it kind of like carried over into when I had lost interest, because it was like, 1990, 91 that it started. But my favorite live action one and my favorite probably thing overall to come out of Saturday mornings was Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Oh, yes.
I never saw that.
I was all about Pee-wee's Playhouse.
And it was popular until he masturbated in a theater, right?
Yes. It was so way ahead of its time. It was The Simpsons before The Simpsons were. Better. I mean, it was incredibly good. What's his name was on it? Not Neo, the other guy. Lawrence Hilton Jacobs. He was not Lawrence Hilton Jacobs. Oh, my God.
Lawrence Fishburne, are you trying to say?
Fishburne, thank you. Yeah. Lawrence Jacobs was boom, boom on freaking Welcome Back, Kotter, which just an episode.
Cowboy Curtis.
Yep. Yeah, Filmation did 1,200 television shows, 50 series, and 5 full motion pictures. That's a lot of work. They had deals for motion pictures every year, but every year they just kept getting pushed back and pushed back and pushed back and not marketed. And that's where they felt their future was. And it just all went away because they could do it cheaper overseas. And if they didn't have the creative control, they couldn't do it. And they face a lot of that same stuff today. I mean, you see The Simpsons, they openly make fun of it, you know?
Yeah.
One thing that I used to watch after Saturday morning cartoons was the, in New York City, I don't know where else, on what's Fox now, I guess it is. They used to do a show called the Creature Features, which was a monster show. And, you know, it was always a Godzilla.
For me, it was Horror Theater.
Horror Theater, they call it? Okay.
Yeah, except it was more like the Draculas, the, you know, Creature from the Black Lagoon, and all the 40s Universal Monster type things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, loved it. Loved it. They had a show called, and I was going to say Blastar, but I'm screwing up. Brave Star it was called. Mm-hmm. And... Brave Star was set to be the next He-Man. It was a better story. It had an American Indian, a Native American protagonist. And it was set on a future world. It was like the Wild West. Instead of six shooters, you had laser guns and you had, you know, crazy horses and stuff. And Mattel, unfortunately, released the toys before they released the show, because they did a show. Filmation did a show and a movie. By the time He-Man came out, the toys came out, the show had already been out for 6 months. The kids knew who the bad guys were, who the good guys were. When they released the show, nobody knew how to play with the toys. And it struck me. I'm like, what do you mean you don't know how to play with the toys? You have to be told how to play with the toys? No. So, but that was That was supposed to, that was what they ended up finally tanking on, was that. And if the failure of that, as being pointed out, that animation was no longer viable in America anymore. I mean, they had Los Angeles Times magazines covered. They called this character the $200 million man based on the money that He-Man had made. I mean, He-Man had made $200 million it was the 80s. That's like, I don't even know how much money today. You could see why that the networks are going the way they're going. It's a shame, but it's the nature of the beast.
Well, it's funny you mentioned He-Man, because a couple days ago I was listening to Kevin Smith's podcast, Fat Man on Batman.
Oh,
he had two episodes where he talked to Mark Hamill, and I mean they talked about everything under the sun.
I gotta listen to it.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I guess other people knew this, but I just never realized how huge of a nerd Mark Hamill is, and like a comic book fan and everything like that. Going back in the day, yeah. But they were talking about, like, naturally he's on the show because of his work as the voice of Joker in Batman the Animated Series and other stuff. But they talk about a lot of different animation stuff, and they were talking about He-Man and. And just like you said, Mattel came up with the name, they came up with the characters, but they, as far as story, I mean, they had no idea and they didn't care. And he was actually saying how, you know, Mattel came to Filmation and said, well, you know, and they asked, well, who are these Masters of the Universe that are listed in the title? And Mattel's like, I don't know. We don't know. We don't care. Come up with something. We don't know. You know, well, who is this guy? Like, is he, you know, they particular henchman of like Merman or somebody? They'd be like, is he a good guy or a bad guy? They're like, I don't know. You decide, you know. So they just basically dumped the toys in there, and you know, and they did what they could. Looks like we lost Noob.
He's back online. I'll just dial him in again.
But well, the only other ones besides Pee-wee's Playhouse, the other ones I would have mentioned that were favorites for me, I've talked about Alvin and the Chipmunks on the show, Real Ghostbusters was another big one for me, but. You know,
was the Real Ghostbusters with the characters from the movie? Because there was that other one. Is that why they called it Real Ghostbusters?
Yeah, it was the characters from the movies. You know, one thing I did find interesting, because I was looking to jog my memory, I was looking back at like stuff that you got, you know, like the lineups that they had. One thing that was kind of interesting to me, because we talked before, I'd mentioned how superheroes didn't really come into my cartoon watching. And I think that's because really by the time I started watching Saturday morning cartoons in the 80s and stuff like that, a lot of the stuff that people like your age and older talk about, like Super Friends and Shazam and, you know, Spider-Man.
Yeah, Spider-Man is amazing, Friends and X-Men.
It was all in the 70s. A lot of that stuff, by the time I started watching Saturday morning cartoons, wasn't on anymore. You know, so that's kind of why for, you know, kids in the 70s, it was kind of like a gateway for a lot of people to come.
I thought those were in the 80s, though, like X-Men.
No. Well, X-Men came about. X-Men wasn't a cartoon till the 90s.
Oh, yeah. It was late. It was on Fox, right?
Yeah, and it was like a after-school thing I would watch sometimes. But I was interested in that, because I was already into comic books, not vice versa, you know. So it's interesting to me that, because I kind of wondered, well, I was so into cartoons, I was so into comics, why didn't I get into, you know, comics through cartoons? But,
You're back.
Yes.
All right, so Chris was just talking about some of the cartoons that were important to him, and I was getting ready to go through my list.
Go, talk to me.
Like we already said, Scooby-Doo was, I would have to say, at the very top of my list. The Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? Because it was almost every year it would be on, and I enjoyed the heck out of it. And the other one that meant a lot to me, and I still can watch today and think it's hilarious, is Bugs Bunny Roadrunner stuff, like Looney Tunes.
Yeah, see, for me, it's got to be the original one, bro.
Yeah, it's the original, and it's just hilarious. Like, one of my favorites is Yosemite Sam, because that motherfucker just gets so frustrated with Bugs. and the more frustrated he gets, the worse off things are. Like, one of my favorite episodes is where they have that, he gets him to do that diving platform, you know, and it keeps getting higher and higher, and he dives into the bucket. I could watch that one over and over again, and Yosemite Sam, and it cracks me up like nobody else, because
my favorite one's the one where he's on pirate ships with Bugs.
Oh yeah, that's
at each other, and he gives them a match to go down and check.
I just love Yosemite because he gets so mad, and the madder he gets, the stupider he gets. He'll do more stupid things, and Daffy is always a plus too, because him and Bugs always have that rivalry. But I also enjoyed Roadrunner because back in the day, you could have violence in cartoons.
Oh, the coyote got jacked up.
Yeah, he would get so fucked up. I mean, he'd buy all this stuff from Acme.
Roadrunner exploding kit, it says on the side of it.
Everything would go back on him. A rock would fall on his head. I mean, no matter what happened, the guy couldn't win. And I even like Speedy Gonzalez, and I liked everything that came out of Looney Tunes. Foghorn Leghorn, I loved him in the dog.
I love Daffy. Daffy used to make me crack up when he used to try and team up with Bugs.
Daffy is my wife's favorite. So, you know, we have the Looney Tunes collection libraries, and they're pretty great, and I can still watch them. But Yosemite is my guy because, man, well, I liked Elmer Fudd too. And Porky Pig, you can't forget him, stuttering guy.
Nope.
And those are timeless. I mean, those go back even before your guys' time.
Yeah, there's even older ones. But from my time is the time that I liked them the most. Because if I go to the earlier stuff, Daffy was a little more crazier and yelling all the time. And he'd be yapping, and it was the when it got to the, like, the Looney Tunes instead of the Merrill Melodies or whatever.
Put Michael Jordan with them. I was like, no, I'm sorry. This is not my Looney Tunes.
But, yeah, that was one that was my favorite. And,
oh, you like that one, yeah?
What?
You like the one with Michael Jordan in it?
Oh, no, I didn't like it.
Oh, okay.
No, I even had a really, really hard time with the brand new one. Like, it's psychologically damaging.
it pisses you off, don't it, man?
I don't know what it is, but it's like trying to make something that was fun not fun. I don't understand, but maybe I'm not the audience for it. There probably is an audience for it.
Hey, but Abby Costello, that guy used to get smacked in the face 3 times an episode. They'd never be able to have that today. And that was the trademark.
Another topic that we should have is, like, you know, comedians and stuff that meant a lot to us, because Abbott Costello, to me, were, like, huge. But Land of the Lost, we talked about that.
That was
the much watch. One of the early cartoons that I'd watch is Willy and the Chopper Bunch. That seemed to be, like, an early one. And I always enjoyed that one. That was with just, you know, the choppers and the Willy car. And I enjoyed
it. I like Speed Buggy.
Speed Buggy was good. That was like the racing team. And then that leads me to one of my favorites. And the reason this one was one of my favorites was because as a kid, my parents used to love, and I used to sit down, and we used to love watching Battle of the Network Stars.
Oh, yeah. I used to watch my folks.
Because you could see, like, your favorite stars, like $6 Million Man fight somebody else in like a competition, like pull, tug of war and all kinds of other obstacles and stuff.
Everybody.
Yeah, and it had every star that was on.
Humongous. Oh my God, could you imagine?
Yeah, and what that led to, I think, was Scooby-Doo's All-Star Laugh Olympics. And that's where you had the Scooby-Doobies versus the Rottens and, you know, all these different teams that were of made up of characters, the Yogis, the Hanna-Barbera creations were fighting and competing against each other. And the really Rottens were always the ones getting screwed, but they were the funniest. And, man, they're such good cartoons. The Flintstones were always a milestone. The Jetsons, even though those were kind of like made for prime time, eventually they were on Saturday mornings.
Yep. Yep.
And, they originated in prime time, but they were damn good in, on Saturday mornings as well. Spider-Man's Amazing Friends for the superheroes in us, along with Super Friends. Super Friends was my first and favorite love. Well, I don't believe it holds up today.
It doesn't, but it was my favorite too.
It was my favorite. Aquaman being my most favorite. And as time went on, that cartoon got better because it became Challenge of the Super Friends. And that was phenomenal because you had the Legion of Doom. You had real.
That's when they had the real voice. No, there was one they had the actual Adam West and Burt Ward actually do the voices of Batman and Robin.
That was the Adventures of Batman and Robin?
Was that just the event? I thought they had the Super Friends.
Oh, yeah, they were in the Super Friends. You're right. So yeah, those Challenge of the Super Friends, and then it became like the Super Powers, which had Firestorm and Cyborg. And that was always, but I include all those carnations as the same thing in the Super Friends because it almost was on every year. You know what? You just
had a different
version of it. Let's see what else. The X-Men, I don't even remember if they were on Saturday mornings or if
they they premiered on a weekday, actually. I watched them. I tried.
Yeah, so those were the superhero ones. Captain Caveman, we talked about. Scooby-Doo, Dynamutt Hour, I liked.
H.R. Puff and stuff. You got the whole Sid Marty Krofft library. H.R. Puff and stuff. The Bugaloos, the Banana Splits were Filmation, actually. I loved.
Fred and Barney Meet the Shmoo. I used to watch
Shmoo.
Batman Tarzan Adventure Hour. I like watching Tarzan on CBS.
Zorro, believe it or not, I used to love.
Never watched the Zorro.
Zorro, I like. Zorro, it was the same thing. It was the Lone Ranger, Zorro. And there was one other that were almost all identical to the same. It was almost like you could see three of the same plots for both of them. It is another one. Tonto was on every week without fail. Flash Gordon.
Flash Gordon was a damn good cartoon. As a matter of fact, I bought the DVDs of that, the full cartoon. The Incredible Hulk right after Amazing Spider-Man. And
That was the cartoon.
Huh?
The Godzilla cartoon.
Oh, Godzilla. That was good with the little Godzilla. Thunder the Barbarian was huge for me. I love Thunder the Barbarian.
Oh, I'm not going to lose you again, am I?
No.
Well, that had the Kirby connection, right?
Yeah, it does have the Kirby connection. As a matter of fact, I got that for Christmas this year. The whole complete Thunder the Barbarian. Johnny Quest, Space Ghost.
Here's a franchise for you.
Hercules.
I don't think gets a lot. And it is a franchise because they were all tied in together. Wacky Races, right?
Yeah, that was like the Laugh Olympics before the Laugh Olympics.
And it was Dick Dastardly and Muttley.
I love Muttley's laugh. He's like,
I can't do it. Forget it. and then they get to catch that pigeon. Which was the same with Dastardly and Muttley. I think it was the same. I liked, they had a set, and I forget who that, I think it might have been Hanna-Barbera. It was your Huckleberry Hound, your McGilla Gorilla, your Ricochet Rabbit, and your, I can't remember who else that they had on there, which was awesome. They had some shows that, believe it or not, they did like Great Grape Ape. which was basically about a purple King Kong.
Yeah, I like Great Babe. Inch High, Private Eye, Kung Fu Fooey, or Hong Kong Fooey.
Hong Kong Fooey, yeah, that's right.
Hong Kong Fooey. He was a dog. And he was foo.
Hong Kong Fooey.
Number one super. About some of the things we're mentioning is later on they premiered again on USA After School, like USA Network. Mm-hmm. They used to have all the reruns.
Well, that's why, I mean, I'm familiar with so many of these properties because of syndication. And also, I was always, if my dad told me he liked something when he was a kid, I always made me curious about it. I wanted to like it too. So that's what got me watching the Flintstones, the Jetsons. He would talk about when he was a kid, he loved Huckleberry Hound and Foghorn Leghorn. So I saw these guys, and I'm like, okay, you know, I wanted to like them too. And I got interested because he told me those are the ones he liked, you know.
And you got Jason of Star Command, I used to like. That was a live-action one. I used to like the live-action ones because I could, a lot of times, because I couldn't get what I wanted live-action on primetime. You couldn't get superheroes on primetime until later on once Ferrigno broke it and had that horrible Spider-Man series for a while.
I love that Spider-Man. I broke my arm doing that. I mean, when Deadly Dust premiered, I was like, oh my God, Spider-Man.
I missed one of them, and I was thrilled that they were on, but looking back, I'm like, oh, well.
I can't enjoy them today, but Nicholas Hammond as Spider-Man, I remember fondly. Yep.
Captain America showed up, but that wasn't
it. I actually love that. I watched the Doctor Strange 1 movie.
Oh, yeah. It was another one. It was the arc that I was telling you, Jason of Stark Command. Which I enjoyed. Nancy and Sluggo and them guys, I could never get it. I don't know why I couldn't get into those. Here's one for, and this is why it's cross generational. I guarantee you, Chris watched it too. It's the Fat Albert Show. It was on for 11 freaking years.
Yeah, that was a.
Oh, yeah.
That one was the easiest to watch too, because it was so late in the day you had no conflict. Like,
yep.
That's why I always watched, you know, Fat Albert.
11 years. Even Bill Cosby then had another show called Aesop's Fables, where he was Aesop. He played Aesop. It only ran for a year and a half, though.
I watched.
Well, all you had to tell me was Bill Cosby was involved.
Yeah,
I grew up with the Cosby Show, so if it had any connection to Bill Cosby, because you had that, and then you had picture pages that he used to do, where, you know, he would draw stuff.
Picture pages, time to get your pictures.
Oh, my God, that's right.
Yep. So anything that had to do with Bill Cosby, you could sign me up for when I was a kid.
Oh, also in Jason of Stark Command was that guy from Dr. Smith from Lost in Space. He was on that. I'm trying to think of what else. Final Arc was the name of that show I was telling you about, the apocalyptic thing, if anybody wants to.
There was the really early in the morning, and I know this was a primetime thing, but it would happen like right after the color bars. And it would have the
rocket. You might not remember Color Bars. I talked to my daughter about them. She don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
Rocky Bullwinkle Hour with Peabody and Dudley Do-Right and all those.
Savoir-faire is everywhere.
I used to watch that pretty religiously because it was the first thing to come on. I even watched the Smurfs, admit it, because it was the lead-in to Spider-Man and his amazing friends.
I watched Planet of the Apes cartoons. Any Planet of the Apes guys here?
I did not watch the Planet of the Apes. As a matter of fact, I didn't even watch the movies until fairly recently.
I still haven't. It's never been connected with it.
Yeah, I tell you what, this last one was pretty good. I would watch it. Think of it as a new franchise and just check it out.
That's the only one I saw, actually. That's the only one I've seen, and it was a good movie.
Science fiction movie had good emotional ties to it. I enjoyed the heck out of it.
It was well, yeah, it was well done. It's
you're actually rooting for the monkeys in that one.
Yeah. Ark 2 was the name of it. They used to have a flying jetpack for 2 seasons, but you only had about 30 seconds of flying time, right? And what would happen is they'd have a spring-loaded timer in the helmet. So that when you had 20 seconds left of fuel left, it was 34 to 45 seconds worth of fuel. And when you had 20 seconds left, the thing would come down and hit you in the head, so you know you had to land. One guy got hit in the head. He was a little too high. He only made it about 20 feet above the ground before the engine cut out on him. That was the last time they had it on the show. The insurance company said, no more flying jetpack. God. Jeez. Tarzan was an actual good one. You talk about Greystoke Tarzan, Ark 2. I'm trying to think of who else. And Ted Knight was just working everywhere.
Yeah, he was a big name at that time. And I one of the unfortunate things that kind of developed in the 80s is they were trying to save a lot of these properties is the whole, because Muppet Babies was popular, eventually, as a result, you had baby versions of pretty much everything. I mean, that's where A Pup Named Scooby-Doo came out of that. They were just, everything was turning into, like little kid versions. You had Disney babies, they did baby versions of everything.
Here's a legal nightmare for you guys. There was a show that came on, live action, once again, Saturday morning, starring Forrest Tucker and Larry Storch from an old show called F Troop. They were private eyes. They worked with a gorilla in a gorilla costume, naturally. And the name of the show was Ghostbusters. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So at one point in time, you had the Ghostbusters live action show. Then you had the Ghostbusters cartoon from the movie. But because of legal ramifications there, you weren't allowed to use Bill Murray's face or Dan Aykroyd's face or any of the other faces. And then there was a cartoon version of the live-action one. So there's 3 Ghostbusters on all at one time. That's a nightmare.
And that's why the one that I liked and I watched was wasn't Filmation's one. It was that's why they called it the real Ghostbusters.
The real Ghostbusters. Yep.
Yeah, that was the one that had all the characters from the movie, and that was Columbia, I think, and that was the one I watched and really liked.
Yep. After School was always the Bugs Bunny, then the Flintstones. Then it was one, I forget, they would keep changing it. And then the 4:30 movie would come on, and then depending on what it was, I would watch it. If it was Monster Week, I'd watch that. But
mm-hmm.
And then Star Trek would come on at 6 and watch that. But the girl I played Isis, oh my God, I got to save this and post this later for you guys. It's completely clean, don't worry.
So, well, I think that covers most of the stuff I had to mention.
Yeah, everything I had too. So, do you guys want to move into the last topic, which is kind of just like miscellaneous books? Did you guys read any miscellaneous old stuff?
Oh, books?
Comics.
Oh, comics. Oh, gosh.
I got a couple. I guess, maybe we could do fewer than we normally do just because we're at 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And save some for the next time. But yeah, we could, if you want to mention something, start it off, Mike, with something that
I'll mention 2 quick ones. I read Wonder Woman. I'm working on my Wonder Woman collection. I almost have every single one since like 73 or so. And I recently purchased some of them to fill the gaps. And this was a pretty interesting run. I randomly picked up some for this podcast. I read 288 through 290. And this was like a big turning point for Wonder Woman because Roy Thomas took over and the art was done by Gene Colan. they took over the book, and I have to admit that the first issue, Gene Colan's artwork looked very, very strange on Wonder Woman. It was like he had a hard time drawing the bikini suit overneath the skin. It looked very unnatural. It looked very weird. But what is very interesting about this arc is, man, these stories were good. It introduced Silver Swan, like, in... It had so many introductions of Silver Age. Sorry, this is probably Bronze Age. Bronze Age characters. Like, it reintroduced Dr. Psycho, who's that little guy.
Mm-hmm.
It reintroduced Silver Swan, who played a... Both of those characters played a huge part in George Perez's relaunch of Wonder Woman after Crisis. And it was cool seeing their origins, and man, this book was so tied into Earth 2, which made it fascinating. Like, the Steve Trevor that was in this book was actually a Steve Trevor of Earth 2. It was so bizarre, and it was kind of natural because the backup feature at the time was the Huntress, who was on Earth 2, and her father, you know, was Batman, and mother was Catwoman, so it fit right into the book. And at the time, by reading the letters pages, it actually seemed like the Huntress, even though it was an 8-page feature, was more popular than Wonder Woman at the time.
It's a cool character.
And the Huntress was Paul Levitz and who was the artist? I can't remember. The guy who drew Millennium. Can't remember his name.
You got me, buddy.
Oh, Joe Staton. So it's a pretty big name. And Dr. Psycho actually created Steve Trevor into Wonder Man, which, or Captain Wonder, which turned into a weird scenario. But it was interesting kind of how they merged mythology in here, because mythology is a big part of Wonder Woman. The Greek gods, you know, Ares. Instead, they kind of said that Ares merged into Mars, which was the Roman god of war, so Mars was a big character in bringing Silver Swan to try to defeat Wonder Woman. But man, these series were really good, so good that I want to jump into the next run.
What are the issues again, Mike?
This was 288 and 290, and I will say that once Dr. Psycho came in, it seemed like Gene Colan's got in his groove, because he had like a horror, you know, like with Tomb of Dracula and stuff, that he brought that same sort of style, and it looked really nice. So yeah, this is a good series. I'd recommend it for those that are interested in learning about some. These are like first appearance of Dr. Psycho since the Golden Age, so yeah, it's worth it. What else?
Kind of considered one of her
main
nowadays
villains. So yeah, is Silver Swan. So that's what I found fascinating about it, is just learning about it. It started off rocky. That first issue was kind of like, man, I don't know if I like it or not. And then once I got sucked into the context of it, and then the other one, I completed my Young Justice run, which was by Peter David and Todd Knock. And I was missing like issues 4 through 14, and I started issue 4, and man, it's pretty entertaining. It's not meant to be more than what it is. It's more fun than it is, like
one and done's mostly.
Yeah, it's very similar, but there's an ongoing thread. So I'm enjoying that as well. But and I also completed my Savage Dragon. Just about. I have like 4 issues or 5 issues to fill. I picked up Savage Dragon 1/2, which I was missing, which was from Wizard. It was it came out, and you had to order it, you know, through the mm-hmm. Wizard certificate program. And I read Savage Dragon 36.
Wow, you got that? You got that whole run, Mike?
That's 200 something issues at this point, right?
Well, I'm lacking about 6, and those 6 are kind of hard to. They're not hard to find, but I like to go to My Comic Shop, and when they're rare, My Comic Shop bases the prices on how much they have on the shelf. So if they only have one on the shelf, it could be like $15, when in fact it's probably like worth cover price. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah.
Because they have so much inventory. I think they just have, like, computer algorithms.
Yeah, an algorithm based on demand. And
that's why with my comic shop, you can get some really good deals. And then there's some things you're better off finding elsewhere. That's why I look at them for stuff. And then sometimes, like I said, I always mention Comic Collector Live. I go and find some of the shops that are on there. Because it's less based off of, you know, inventory. It's just demand, you know.
Weird.
How popular, how many people out there want them. But I read 2 issues of something called The Chronicles of Corum, The Knight of the Swords. And this was published by First Comics in the 80s. And this is like a fantasy series.
The Chronicles of who?
Corum. Corum.
Okay, cool.
What this was... Keith on DC Noise has talked about Elric before, and this is based on...
He's talked about Driz.
Hey. Yeah, he's talking about Driz too, but Michael Moorcock is the original author of these. He's British, I think.
Well aware of him. I know him.
Yeah, but... Moorcock, I believe, is British for additional penises.
Yes.
But yeah, he created Elric.
Yeah, you said that just so you can make that joke, didn't you? You didn't read this book, did you?
Oh, I did read it, I did have that joke prepared in advance. That was a spur of the moment. But he's a novelist. He created the character Elric. At this point, First had already done some comics on Elric. They'd also done some comics based on one of his other characters, Hawkmoon. And Corum, he did like 2 trilogies. So this is actually, but it's interesting because the creators of the actual comic are also names. You have Mike Baron is the writer of Nexus and Grimjack. Also like kicked off the Wally West Flash. And Mike Mignola is the penciler.
Nice work, huh?
Of Hellboy, obviously. And it's what was cool is, you know, part of the style of Hellboy, and it's, you know, it makes sense for the story, is there's a lot of shadow, a lot of shadowing. It's very dark. So it was cool to see Mignola artwork in... without as much shadowing. He still uses it a lot for effect, but it's a different kind of an environment, a different kind of story. So,
the Dark Horse book?
This is actually First Comics.
Okay, good.
So the whole deal here is, like I said, it's a fantasy story, and it is interesting. I did find it interesting. I mean, basically, to break it down really quickly, you have... 2 ancient races, and they've been around for thousands and thousands of years. They hate each other pretty much, but when the story starts, they've been around for so long that they've kind of settled into complacency. They've given up on warring, and they just keep to themselves. And while they're doing their own thing, the race of man, of humans, starts up, and these other older races are complacent enough that they don't really pay humans any mind until it's too late. And Corum is one of these older races, and his father comes to him and says, you know, I'm having, like, they have this ability to sense and to travel in other planes of existence, and he says, you know, I'm having trouble sensing the outer planes. Can you go check out what's going on? And what Corum finds out is that some of the humans have taken to killing these older races, and their enemies, Corum's enemies, like, he's one of the 2 older races. The other older race are pretty much at this point been subjugated, and they're just slaves to the humans at this point. So Quorum, he's always been a peaceful individual, but he quickly has to learn what it is to feel anger and vengeance. He gets captured by the humans, and the only way he's able to escape is by using his ability to travel in other planes of existence. And he quickly learns he suffers some injuries. They chop one of his hands off before he's able to escape. And it basically is kind of going to follow, it looks like. He discovers that a lot of even his own people have been slaughtered. You know, they're just, these humans are basically, you know, without any sort of prejudice, are just attacking the strongholds of these other races and killing men, women, and children, basically, across the board. Very brutal. And like I said, I only read two issues, but it looks like, you know, essentially the story is going to be about Quorum, as he's really one of the last of these older races, despite the fact that, you know, it really is kind of clear that the older races, their time is gone, and it's the time of man now. He's going to kind of do his best to sort of stem the tide, as it were, and try to survive. So, I got into the story. I thought it was cool. And like I said, it's from the mid-80s, and it's cool to see Mignola artwork outside of his own, you know, creations before he did Hellboy and really got to be known for that. So,
was his style similar?
Yeah, I would say it's pretty similar. Like I said, it's kind of, because it's, obviously we're dealing with drawings, but I keep wanting to call it brightly lit. It's a lot more colorful because of the nature of the story, and because it's work for hire, I guess, or whatever. So he's just doing the penciling. Inks are by Rick Brichette, and colors are by Ripley Thornhill. But it's good. It's good stuff. It's good art. And, it's almost like you can, like the thing with Hellboy, like I said, it's so heavily shadowed. I even at times find myself wondering, like, is the shadow just a shortcut, or, you know, so it's kind of neat to see, Mignola on something that's so, so differently,
a little bright,
you know, so the style looks similar, but it's so differently colored, and the subject matter is different enough that it's pretty neat.
Cool.
Yeah. So I got these, I think, like 50 cents a piece. So, it's one of those things that they're not cheap because of the quality. They're just cheap because they're out there, and, you know, I guess there's not a huge demand for it, but it's, you more than get your money's worth for them.
Right up my alley. I read Robert Jordan Wheel of Time. That's so it's like right up my alley.
Yeah. So you probably dig these. It's worth looking into.
I'm going to give you and all of your listeners a comic book right now. Give it to you. It's not for everyone. It's brutal, but there's violence, and there's sex, and parts of it are graphic.
Black Kiss 2.
No. This is called Crossed, Wish You Were Here. It's a free webcomic. You can go just type in Crossed, Wish You Were Here in your Google browser. It'll take you there. There's a link there for chapters. And volume 1 goes up to 22 chapters. In volume 2 right now is already up to chapter 13. And this, I don't know if you guys are familiar, but I know Mike is familiar with
it. Oh, I'm a religious. I haven't read this Simon Spurrier webcomic, though, but I did buy the print. So.
It is good. Basically, are you familiar with this, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I'm familiar. It's actually the only Cross that I've read, because it's, like you said, it's free and it's
a webcomic. Oh, you have read? Okay.
I haven't read the whole thing. I've read a little bit of it. I've read I don't know how far I got because it's harder to tell. You know, it's not, they're like installments, but I have read some of it just because, like I said, it was free and I wanted to kind of, because Mike's always talking about Cross and I wanted to sample something. But I also know, Mike, you've said at times, I don't, you haven't read this, but you've said other Simon Spurrier stuff you've not really connected with, right?
Yes, that's the one that's kind of, it's the only one that I haven't read because of Simon Spurrier. Because all the other guys like Garth Ennis, David Laugham, you know, all the other guys that have done it, Hein, any of the ones, I love their work. So I've kind of hit away from the Simon Spurrier, but I do have it and I will read it. But I like the monthly that comes out, it actually comes out twice a month now. Cross Badlands is so damn awesome.
Oh, I love it. I'm sorry, Chris, were you done? I'm sorry, Chris, go ahead. I just jumped right into a Cross. I'm sorry. It was a night, last night of drinking.
No, what I pretty much wrapped up what I was going to say about Quorum, if that's what you mean.
Yeah. Anything else?
Did you have anything, did you have any old stuff you checked out?
Does it reach the time? It probably doesn't. I'm trying to check out the Cuba, My Revolution is the name of it. It's a Vertigo book. It's an old, I don't know how old it is. Okay. I'm trying to think of how old. Nope. I will not go into Cuba. My no, 2010 does not reach our limit. I gotta remember. Okay, go on, guys. I'll tell you what I have read, and I've started again, and I will continue till I finish. I have started reading the Avengers again, the first volume, and starting from issue 160 on. Is awesome. From 160 to 163 has to deal with the Grim Reaper, who is nice. Wonder Man's brother, who has been brought back from the dead, apparently. And the Grim Reaper wants to know what's up. And the artist on this one, I mean, they had such great teams back in the day. This was Jim Shooter and George Perez, a couple of names you might have heard of.
Nice.
So it's called The Trial is the story, and it starts, like I said, in 160. So,
Yeah, I love the Green Reaper. It's awesome.
I've been reading The Avengers from the beginning again, so I'm up to 160 now. So.
Nice.
So you started with number one?
Yes.
Nice.
Very cool. All right. Well, I think we've wrapped this one up. Steve, I want to thank you for joining us.
Anytime.
I want you to plug your podcast and give out your information so people can find you.
Okay. Well, the name of the website we run is called alteredegos.com. The spelling on that is ALT, the number 3, RED. EGOS.com. Remember that first E is a 3. And we do the Altered Egos comic book podcast. And I also do a solo show called Noobs Views. For the most part, we're family friendly and, or safe for work at least. And we try and come out weekly. Also, you can find us on Facebook.
Oh, shit.
Thank you. And my dog has just chimed in. He had a plug, apparently.
All right. We're found at the geekbrunchpodcast.com. It's Chris and me. And Chris is at MythMakingETC on Twitter. I'm Mike Myers Brunch. You can send us emails or actually the comments on the website are not actually working now. We didn't used to have that working. And now you can leave a comment on the website, or you can go to Forum for Geeks and scroll down to Geek Brunch on the episode thread. Like Noob, you can send us ideas of what you want us to cover and stuff like that. Like, this was Noob's idea about the Saturday morning cartoons, and we'll be covering other topics that people suggest. So keep bringing them to the show.
As they come to me, I'll keep shooting them at you. Like I said, we run into hard times sometimes coming up with topics. So anytime I come up with something that's in your warehouse, I'll shoot it to you guys.
All right. Chris, do you have anything else you want to mention?
I don't think so. Next time we'll be continuing to make our way through the Kirby Fourth World stuff, I think. I got it right here, so I'll say... I know we're going to get a Mr. Miracle issue because we didn't this time. Yeah, we have Mr. Miracle number 4, the Forever People number 5, and the New Gods number 5 next time. I think that Forums for Geeks, you can scroll down under the podcast forums. There is Altered Egos is there as well, and we got Geek Brunch. Mike has started a project there where he is recording his 4 out of 5. There's some 4 out of 5s, but yes, his rating out of 5s of everything that he's reading comic book wise and also movies that he's watched and stuff. So you can maybe chime in there. Stop by, tell us what old comics or movies or TV shows you've been checking out. I'm always popping in to see if anyone's posting anything, so you will be heard if you drop by there.
And join the Facebook page. Search for Geek Brunch Podcast. Chris always posts the covers of every book we talk about. We could probably also post some of the cartoons for this one, like some of the stuff that came out, some of the images we talked about. We'll put those in the show notes. What was your favorite cartoon? So I can put it in there, Chris.
I think my favorite Saturday morning show was Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Okay.
The favorite one that was animated was probably Real Ghostbusters.
Real Ghostbusters. All right. How about you, Noob?
It's gotta be Scooby-Doo for the time.
Yeah, that's gotta be mine too. And then Land of the Lost for live action.
Yeah, we're right in sync.
Yeah. We're a little bit far apart, but we still come to the same conclusion.
Yeah, right in sync there, man.
All right, well, I want to thank you for joining us, Noob, and we'll talk to you soon. And
anytime, guys. Anytime you're looking for a third voice, glad to oblige.
Well, thank you. It was a great topic, great discussion, and I enjoyed the Kirby talk too.
Thanks.
Anybody who wants to share Kirby love, we can deal with that.
There's not enough of it. Now, if we can only get Steve Ditko to come out of his office, we'll be all right.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, take care and enjoy the Super Bowl.
All right,
guys.
All right. See ya.
Have fun. Take care.
Bye.
The Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour.
Oscar-winning rabbit, Bugs Bunny.
And also starring my fast-feathered friend, the Roadrunner.
Roadrunner, meep, meep. The child is after you. Roadrunner, meep, meep. If he catches you, you're through. Roadrunner,
meep, meep.
The child is after you. Roadrunner, if he catches you, you're through. The child is really after you.
When will he learn that he never gets bored if he dies? Beep, beep. Poor little Roadrunner never bothers anyone.
The Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour.
Sports fans, to the All-Star Laugh-O-Lympics.